It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech. What a show we've got for you. Amy Webb is here. Mike Masnick from Tech Dirt. My buddy Ian Thompson from The Register. Fortnite booted off the App Store. Why? What's happening? And will that lawsuit have any chance of success? Uber and Lyft say, we're out of here. And the conflict with China. It's more than just TikTok, Amy Webb explains. It's all coming up next on TWiT. This Week in Tech comes to you from TWiT's LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to make securing your employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/TWiT to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is TWiT, This Week in Tech, episode 784, recorded Sunday, August 16th, 2020. Karsten has pictures. This Week in Tech is brought to you by Worldwide Technology. WWT's Advanced Technology Center is like no other testing and research lab, with more than $500 million of equipment, including solutions from key partners like HPE and Intel. And it's virtual, so you can access it 24/7. To learn more about WWT, the ATC, and become a member of their growing community, go to WWT.com/TWiT. And by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. Thinking about moving your data storage to the cloud? Wasabi is enterprise-class cloud storage at 1/5 the price of Amazon S3 and faster than the competition, with no fees for egress or API requests. And no complex storage tiers. Start a free trial at wasabi.com. Enter the code TWIT. And by LastPass. Allow your remote workforce the ability to do their best work without jumping through hoops. Ensure your business's security with LastPass. Visit LastPass.com/TWIT to find out how they can help you. And by ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN is ridiculously fast. You can stream everything in HD quality with zero buffering for 3 extra months free with a 1-year package. Go to expressvpn.com/TWiT. It's time for TWiT This Week in Tech, the show where we get together with strangely dressed tech journalists and talk about what's been happening. This week, apparently this week, we are all characters from Fortnite. I'm not sure exactly what is going on. Ian Thompson is here. Unaccountably, his hair and mustache and even eyebrows are now slightly green.
Yes, indeed. Karsten is a very persuasive person in that regards, but my wife is refusing to kiss me until I shower.
I swear to God, Karsten
won't last long.
He has pictures or something. He's able to convince
Never
us.
Never let this guy go into politics. He could persuade us to do something insane.
Also with us from the Future Today Institute, our favorite futurist, the only one I know, Amy Webb, who is living in the future today. That is a good look, Amy. Thank you.
Thank you. It's nice.
Purplish, pinkish wig, strange future glasses. The very, very kind that Amy predicts we'll all be wearing in the next decade or so. There's certainly augmented reality going on those glasses. I can tell.
Yes, and I printed a necklace just for
tonight. Ooh, a Tesseract necklace. That's cool.
Excellent.
So do you do the 3D printing thing? Obviously you do.
I don't know. I can take it or leave it. We do 3D print part replacement parts for things.
Wow.
And my daughter prototype stuff, but it's more of a toy, really.
Yeah, so somebody called the radio show and said, I want to get my mother-in-law. She's really into cookies. She wants a 3D printer to print cookie cutters. And I said, just go to Target.
I mean, I can't think of a design. Yeah, that I wouldn't do. We did try to extrude chocolate. That I would not attempt to again.
Do not. It seems like these 3D printers are more work than they're really fun.
They are. And especially if you don't have any background in CAD, trying to get a design.
Oh, it's crazy. Yeah.
Into the right format.
And then you got to calibrate it. And the first one always looks like the first pancake, literally. Yeah. And then it's just...
And honestly, it's fun to play with. It also, it's a lot of plastic, and at some point that stuff is going to get thrown out, and I don't love the idea of contributing additional plastic, you know, into the garbage.
Yeah, good. All that PLA. I'm dressed. Apparently, it's a toss up between Eddie Munster and Uncle Fester. I don't know which I am. Mixing the memes on that one. And also, we're thrilled to have from Tech Dirt the return of Mike Masnick, who is now regretting probably his agreeing to appear on the show today. He's living in his blue room.
That's wonderful.
Dabu-dee, dabu-dye, I was blue, dabu-dee, dabu-dye. Actually, the reason we're here armed... Whoa! I didn't know the gun was loaded. The reason we're here armed...
A lot of Americans say that, yeah.
Is because you can't play Fortnite on iOS anymore or Android. It's hard to hit the camera. Let me just see if I can really... Yeah, we'll get there. Fortnite clearly was... itching for a fight and decided to take this time to modify the in-app purchases on its app, both on iOS and Android, in order to get pulled down on both. At which point they released a video that oddly they had just ready to hand called 1980 Fortnite. That may remind you a little bit of a video that we saw in 1984. People sitting, watching a giant screen, a young woman with, well, it's not a sledgehammer, actually. It's a unicorn hobby horse. And she's running away from the police. She arrives and tosses it through the screen, which smashes. And then Epic Games has defied the App Store monopoly. In retaliation, Apple is blocking Fortnite from 1 billion devices. Join the fight to stop 2020 from being 1984. Hashtag free Fortnite. They were ready. They also went to court, sought an injunction. They did the same thing to Google. They didn't have a video ready for Google. I don't know. Maybe they thought Google wouldn't pay any attention. You may remember that Tim Sweeney of Epic didn't put Fortnite on the Google Play Store at first, saying you should sideload it because we don't want to pay the 30%. Eventually, they gave in. Mike, is there legal merit in what Epic is doing? Will they prevail in court or can they?
It's a big hill to climb. That doesn't mean they won't win. They might. But if I were taking odds on whether or not Epic would prevail, I would say they are unlikely to prevail. Though I was impressed. Not only did they have that 1984 video, they actually referenced 1984 in the complaint. So that their marketing legal team.
It's a 60-page complaint. I don't think they wrote that overnight. No.
They had, but it's impressive. Not only did they have it ready, but that they had worked out with the marketing this whole framing.
Wait a minute. That's not though. I think that's part of. In a way, that I think if I'm the judge, that's going to taint this a little bit because it's so clear that they kind of set this whole thing up. That they prepared for months for this moment.
And part of the thing that's interesting about it, I guess, is that, you know, if you look at it from Apple's perspective, they were going to be in trouble no matter which decision they made, right? If they sort of let Fortnite get away with this, then everybody else would be complaining that, they're giving sort of special treatment to Fortnite. And then, of course, when they say, well, Fortnite is violating the rules, so therefore we're gonna pull them from the store, then they have all these other issues. So no matter which way it was going to go, like Apple... didn't have any good choices. And I guess Google was picking sides and decided they were going to, realizing that if Apple loses, they're going to be in trouble too.
Yeah. Apple, of course, is already under the gun in the EU over App Store monopoly. In the United States, Tim Cook was brought up in front of Congress along with three other executives, as you know, a couple of weeks ago. And that was one of the issues that Congress was interested in, the antitrust subcommittee We'll have a report, probably not till the end of the year or early next year, about this. But there's some concern the FTC is looking into it, that maybe Apple is monopolistic. And then on the other hand, and I'll give this argument so you guys don't have to, a lot of people I know say, hey, Apple, it's as if Apple built a great mall and Forever 21 moved in and said, well, but we don't want to pay you any rent. We just want to be in your mall. They're freeloading, Epic's freeloading on what Apple has built with its platform and its store. Do you agree, Amy? Does that seem reasonable?
Yeah, so this is, there's a couple of things happening here. One, we don't have a clear definition for what the future of distribution would look like. So what's interesting about, I think it's interesting that Epic is trying to initiate an antitrust battle, because the hearing that happened a week ago or 2 weeks ago reflects lawmakers sort of scrambling to, first of all, group together companies that really are doing disparate things. And second of all, using policy that was written in 1890. So the Sherman Act was written.
I didn't really know about app stores.
Right. But this is important because there's very little substantive analogy to make about the means for distribution in a digital setting and the railroad system. So that being said, this is an interesting, this could be an interesting and possibly the only way to really crack through. And that's because this is a limited circumstance. So Apple charging 30%, if you look at other industries, that percentage of rev share is higher than what you would see elsewhere.
It's not, though, higher than on the consoles. Sony, Microsoft, and Nintendo charge the same 30% fee and have the same control. This all dates back to the days when Atari and Nintendo were swamped by crappy games, and they learned very early on, hey, we got to keep tight control over what's on our console. Fortnite doesn't seem to mind that 30%.
No, it's the data on the other end. So the key difference here is that when you've got a console game with heavy DRM protections, you know, you're talking about limited use case. Now with a game being on a different type of device, one that hinges on the Play Store and Apple Store, there's a wealth of other data there. And so I think if they were, it really depends. If they try to define antitrust very narrowly, I think they have a shot. I think it could be more compelling for them to talk about the future of all of this data that's being generated, and the fact that in and of itself is also, you know, that has value. And they can't easily access those data in addition to having to pay the fees. And you can't, you know, there is no other way to play Fortnite. You either have to jailbreak and, I guess, somehow.
That's true. On Google, you could sideload, but there's nothing you can do on Apple.
Right. So I think Google had, I don't think I have as strong of a case against Google, but the reality is that Google, Facebook, Amazon, and Apple are all facing some flavor of antitrust, and the blanket application we already know doesn't apply. So what's interesting here is Epic could force the hand of Apple and start to change parts of the industry.
What is the, so Apple's response to this, by the way, let me paraphrase it, is this is disingenuous of Epic. They've had apps on our App Store for 10 years. They've benefited from their presence on the App Store for 10 years. Now, Apple says Epic's business interests lead it to push for a special arrangement that would be unfair to other developers. Whose reputation is more at risk here, Epic's or Apple's? Ian?
Honestly, I think this is a really interesting case because, I mean, let's face it, you don't get Fortnite because it's on the Apple Store. You get Fortnite because it's a really good game. And Apple has said they run a closed ecosystem. If you want apps on our phones or on our hardware, you have to go through us. And that seems blatantly anti-competitive. I admit I'm a foreigner over here, but even so.
Why does that have anything to do with anything?
Well, I mean, not knowing quite how
what are antitrust laws?
Your antitrust,
they're different. I've been told, Mike's probably more an expert on this than I am, but they're different in the in the EU than they are here in the United States.
Oh, very much so. Yeah. You would not get away with this in the EU. But I mean, US regulators are very much the sort of, oh, well, do whatever you like and we'll issue a minor fine. Honestly, I'm with Epic on this one. And yes, Apple sleptwalked into this. You know, they walked right into an ambush. They had the Epic had the trailer ready to go. They had the lawsuits ready to go. This was done around about the time that Apple was facing antitrust talks in Congress. This was a hit job, pure and
although
simple.
If I'm a Fortnite player, I might be pissed off on the one hand because we know Tim Sweeney personally made $7 billion last year from Fortnite. The Epic made even more. So it's not like they're hurting. Giving Apple their 30% hasn't hurt them.
Well, no, but it's the principle of the thing, surely. I mean, yes, okay. Apple says if you want to run software on our phones, you have to give us 30%. That seems to me to be anti-competitive. You know, it's Apple.
Well, it's not the percentage. It's not the percentage. It's the fact that there aren't others in the market where you can easily, you know. If it's the case that most people have one of two operating systems and the preponderance of young people who play Fortnite are on iOS, then it would follow that you can't play the game reasonably in any other way because Apple has minimized the market and collapsed whatever competition there might have been.
By the way, we should mention, I don't know how this will impact it, but Tencent has a significant ownership stake in this. So
they have a significant ownership at stake in everything. A lot of companies.
Yeah, everybody.
Right now.
Yeah, pretty much everybody. So, somebody wrote, I think in Ars Technica, they wrote, there's also a risk to Apple here because they're going to miss out on a whole, if this continues, on a whole generation of young gamers who will not. Mm. But where are they going to go? Are they going to go to Google? I mean, or maybe they'll just go to a console. I don't really know.
It reminds me of Sony. Remember when Sony went through the DRM challenges and pissed off everybody?
Yes.
The rootkit scenario.
People still hold that against Sony. I still talk to people all the time and say, I'll never own anything Sony.
Right. So, you know, Apple's in the process of trying to launch its own system. Google is still trying to get its system, cloud-based gaming system, off the ground. You know, there's a lot of nuance here that just the average person playing Fortnite either doesn't care or doesn't know anything about. Most people have never heard of Tencent.
Right.
So I think that Apple has a lot to lose here in terms of, again, you know.
So the backlash will hit Apple more than it would hit anybody.
I think
from a long-term
strategic vantage point, this is potentially, challenge. It's bad for Apple.
Mike?
But it certainly could go against Epic, too. I mean, it kind of depends on how all of this shakes out. And there's certainly been some anger about Epic and the way that they've done certain things.
I don't think, for instance, the Google boycott worked so well for them.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things where, Epic sort of made the first move here. And I think a lot of people will see that and say, like, yeah, this is obviously just sort of a negotiating tactic. And as part of that negotiating tactic, they pushed things and effectively got themselves banned from the App Store. Is that Apple's fault or is that Epic's fault? And I think people can come down on either side, but I'm not so sure that I would be positive that Apple is the one that most people would blame. I think a lot of people might start blaming Epic for they made a ton of money doing it this way for a long, long time, and suddenly they want a better deal. Epic has pissed off a lot of people.
It doesn't look
years,
as, it see, looks greedy, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, by the way, they said that they wouldn't take a penny from this settlement. They're not seeking damages. They just want Apple to change its policies. Now, I should point out that, in my opinion, the company that has a much stronger case is Microsoft here. Apple also is not going to allow the xCloud service, Microsoft streaming game service, on iOS. And I think Microsoft can make a very strong case. We're no different than Netflix. You allow Netflix. It's a streaming game, not a streaming movie. It's interactive. But otherwise, we're pretty much the Netflix of gaming. And you're not going to allow us on here because you say you can't vet the individual games? That makes very little sense. I think Microsoft would have a stronger case that Apple's doing this in their own economic interest, that they don't want you to play Stadia, the Google games, or xCloud, the Microsoft games, or GeForce Now, or any of the other streaming services. They want you to play Apple Arcade. And I think that's a very interesting economic argument. Interestingly, Microsoft, at least to this point, is not pursuing this in court. I think Microsoft's going to let the court of public opinion beat Apple on this one. And I think maybe they will come out better than Epic has kind of come out on this.
Well, I mean, who would have thought Apple would be monopolistic in its business practices?
Oh, I know.
Never would have.
Never.
Then again, Microsoft pointing the finger is.
But I'm gonna put on my purple wig here and say, oh, I already have it on. I'm gonna say there is a case to be made. Maybe you guys can shoot this down. I'm not making this case, but I've heard this made many, many times. Apple created all this value. They created the iPhone. They created the App Store. They created an ecosystem people wanted to participate in. And for most developers, Apple's doing a great service. They're providing a marketplace. They're providing storefront. They're providing bandwidth. It's much easier for the developer. If you went to Ingram Micro to distribute your game in the old days, they took a hell of a lot more than 30%. So Apple's 30% is a small amount for distributing a program. If you compare it to the old days when you had software in boxes, this is a preferable system. And some developers do think it's preferable. Mike?
And I would say even if you go back to early phones, if you go back to pre-iPhone days, you know, when you had like Verizon and AT&T, that they had total control over their phones. And in order to get even, you know, you didn't have a marketplace even. If you wanted to get an app onto the phone, you had to negotiate some sort of deal with Verizon or AT&T or whoever. And they would, you know, they would take a huge chunk of cash up front. You had all these, you know, phone app developers who were raising a bunch of, you know, venture capital just to hand it off to the telcos. You know, the iPhone, Apple App Store setup is much more preferable. It's why we have a mobile ecosystem today in the first place. So I actually think that argument makes a lot of sense. The question then is, you know, to get back to what Amy was saying is, you know, how do you define this market from an antitrust perspective? And is it monopolistic? Is it anti-competitive? Well, that, again, sort of depends on what do you consider this marketplace to be. But you do have to admit that Apple created this whole entire space in the first place. And that's, you know, that's not nothing.
Yeah. So what is the, how does this get resolved? I don't think we want to let this go through the courts. What could Apple do to make people happy? Amy, do you have any thoughts about, I mean, part of the problem is as you point out, we've never seen anything like this before. So there's no precedent. Our current antitrust laws are completely unrelated to what's going on here. So is there a compromise Apple could come up with that would make everybody happy?
Right. So all of the big tech companies, Apple included, have government relations departments.
Right.
Whose job it is, right, to meet with and help write policy. They all have corporate foreign policy departments now. I think when I remember first starting to hear grumblings about the 30%, and Apple booting developers out of the store, I think what happened was there's just a lack of transparency. And I think with a lot of these companies, you're not divulging IP. I don't think you're giving strategic or competitive advantage by simply saying in a very transparent way, this is our roadmap. This is what's happening. Here's why we're doing it. I think the problem is none of that communication happened. And people are pretty, and all of this is also happening, let's not forget, during an incredibly volatile time when people are having a hard time just confronting this uncertainty because of, you know, the virus and crazy weather events this time of year, and all of the social injustice protests that are happening. So from a regulatory perspective, at this point, you know, we'll have to see if a judge picks up the suit. We'll have to see if Congress does anything, and whatever direction it winds up going in, and it'll be several months, if not years, before the whole thing gets sorted out. But in the court of public opinion,
that's Apple, the real court,
right? Apple would do itself well at this point, by I think opening up that line of communication a little bit better and talking about its plans for the future. Steve Jobs used to do that really well. You know, you sort of saw the future when he took the stage and they unveiled a new product. But when there weren't big press conferences or events happening, he was constantly talking about his vision for the future. I think a lot of this felt like it came out of nowhere and that Apple was suddenly trying to be super greedy. It's a business. And this is what in business school we call network value, or I'm sorry, a value network, right?
Right.
So,
right.
the whole thing falls apart unless everybody's contributing and earning value and creating value and making money.
Well, there's another phrase they use in business school, rent seeking. And I think from Tim Sweeney's point of view, from Epic's point of view, is you want a piece of our action for doing nothing.
Yeah.
Right. And so that's rent seeking. So this is, I think here's my take on this is Apple painted themselves into a corner. When they first started this up, it made a lot of sense. It was a simple thing. They probably didn't look far enough down the road to see these problems. They thought about it and they said, look, we're going to give you bandwidth. We're going to give you a storefront. We're going to give you the option to be in this ecosystem we've created. We're going to give customers a safe place to go where they don't have to worry about their kids. They don't have to worry about themselves. They don't have to worry about malware. The store will be highly curated. It's going to be a win all around. Developers are going to love it. Users are going to love it. And I think that they were right in the initial thing. But what's happened is the world has evolved. And now we've got to this position where the lines aren't quite as clear. xCloud's a really good example. What is it, a game store? Is it Netflix? What exactly is it? And I don't think that Apple's policies encompass the range of activities now that are going on in the store. I don't think Apple acted out of greed. I think they acted out of trying to make a good marketplace and having a sensible plan, but they didn't see far enough down the road as to the problem that was going to crop up here. And well, they have painted themselves a corner because you can't give Epic a deal because then now that opens the door for a lot of other people. A lot of small developers have quite rightly criticized the App Store for inconsistent policies, not being clear why stuff was pulled. You want us to make that blue? That's the problem? There's all sorts of little issues that have been bubbling around in the App Store for years. It's kind of partly because it's too successful. There's too many new apps.
Apple obviously doesn't want to have to negotiate individual deals with individual software companies because that's a massive pain in the ass for them. But, I mean, in terms of, Apple has said, yes, we've created this app store. We should take 30%. But it works for a lot of apps, but a lot of the people who want to buy a specific app couldn't care less where it comes from. They just want solid code. And for Apple to claim 30% on that seems problematic, to say the least.
Well, so here's the issue. Leo said this somewhat in passing, but the real challenge here is that there was no longer-term strategic plan. There hasn't been at Fortnite. There might have been some big picture idea, but Fortnite's had its fair share of IP battles. So part of the problem is a lot of the planning process gets front-loaded. We want to do this. This is our big strategic plan. And maybe companies go out 18 months, 2 years, 5 years. That feels like the distant future. And what they forget is that that sort of beginning of that plan gets reset at zero with every new business day.
Right.
And so if you're not able or willing to recalibrate and see strategy as something that gets worked on all the time and foresight as something more than cool trends, then you're okay. But very few, none of these companies that we've talked about, among all of the other big tech companies, foresight's not part of the product process.
Yeah.
What should happen is you should go from cool idea or hackathon or whatever to risk modeling next, and also opportunity modeling, because there are probably ways to derive value that, and new synergies within the organization that nobody thought of. And once you get past, something that's a rigorous modeling session, then you go and you build or you mitigate some of that risk and then you build. What happens is that doesn't happen until way later in the process when everybody's trying to sort of fix things. Right.
Yeah. And that's what you come in and do for companies. You say, let's do. I can't wear this stupid wig. Let's. Nobody's going to take me seriously. Some guy in a purple wig saying this. So you have my permission, all of you, to. Well, you can't do anything about it, Ian. You're stuck. Sorry. I was wearing it out of solidarity, to be honest, but I'm sorry. Solidarity only goes so far. No, I forgot what I was saying.
You were telling Ian to go shave his eyebrows and mustache.
Go ahead, Mike. Go ahead.
I was going to jump in and just say, like, you know, I still think to some extent that this is really just a negotiation, right? You have two giant companies that are effectively negotiating with each other.
Yeah.
And I think in the end, you know, it would not surprise me at all if Apple effectively caves and says, okay, we're going to cut, you know, Epic a better deal here. And yes, the fear, the reason they don't want to do this, because they don't want to have to negotiate with every single developer. But the fact is, not every developer and very, very few developers are as big or as powerful as Epic. And so therefore, they'll probably cut a favorable deal with Epic. And because of that, they'll probably end up having to cut a favorable deal with, you know, a few other very large players, and everybody else will have to suck it up and take the 30%.
They kind of already did this with Amazon, didn't they? In order to get Amazon Prime.
Yeah.
And that's part of the problem, is they've already done special consideration. If I were, honestly, if I were Apple, I'd just hold the line and say, sorry, 30%, it's our store. There's one thing Apple could and probably should have done, and I wish they had done, that would probably help them in court. The problem right now is that Apple has an iron grip on what can be run on that phone, because they're the only, unlike Google, they're the only one with the App Store. I think Google gets off the hook because Google just says sideload, no big deal. But Apple, no, no, they have an iron grip. What Apple should be doing, and I wish they would do, is supporting progressive web apps. That is, websites that turn into apps when you bookmark them on the phone. It's kind of like back in 2007, except that the technology is much more advanced. Both Google and Microsoft support it very well. And you could easily have, there's a Twitter mobile app, for instance, that turns into a Twitter app on the iPhone that's indistinguishable from the native app. You could easily do that. And then Apple could say, but Your Honor, there is a way that this could be on it if they would do this. We're not preventing that. We just think that our customers want a curated experience in the App Store. We think that's worth something. We think 30%, given the history of distribution deals, is a very fair amount. It's exactly what consoles charge. And it's not more than we deserve for what we've created. And there's an alternative. And that's what's lacking right now, is they can't say, and there's an alternative. Is that going to be a problem for them, Mike?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that if they had that ability, I think it would be good for the world and the internet.
Yes.
And mobile devices in general.
Yes.
So I'm all for that. and yes, it would give them a much better argument in court. I think if they really wanted to go through the entire litigation process, they have a fairly strong argument.
I think
especially
so too.
With the antitrust laws the way they are right now. But going through that process is extremely expensive and annoying and distracting in its own way. And so they might not want to do that. But, you know, so I don't know if they need that to win the case. So I don't know if that makes a difference in terms of how well the case will turn out. But I think in general, that's not a bad idea.
This actually case is being litigated right now in another case that actually went to the Supreme Court over standing, not over the case itself. The App Store has been challenged, and the Supreme Court said that the plaintiffs do have standing. I can't remember if it was a class action. I actually don't remember the details of this, but there is another lower court that is actually looking at Apple's monopoly right now. So there's action on many, many fronts going on. But if I'm Apple, I hold the line. I say Epic will blink. Epic, we know Epic blinked with Google. When they released Fortnite as a sideload, it did not go well for them. They gave in. And I think if I'm Google, I don't blink. I just say, hey, sorry, dudes, that's the rule. You made a lot of money last year. They're worth $17 billion, I think. You have not a leg to stand on. You're benefiting from what we've created.
I do have to say, Apple, I think, has a better case in this than Google does. Because Apple at
really?
Least rigorous. Well, yeah, because I think, honestly, Apple rigorously checks apps on its site for malware. They are better at miles ahead from Google on that.
So it really is curated, that store.
Well, yeah. I mean, you're paying for a certain amount of security in that you know an engineer has gone through this, and you're unlikely, if you download a fart app, to get a rootkit installed on your machine.
You only get the best fart apps on
exactly,
iOS.
Exactly. Yeah. But when you're dealing with something like Fortnite, or I'm showing my age here, but I mean, imagine if Doom had been released. You couldn't have released Doom on the App Store. because they would have.
Yeah, there, no, there are a lot of software models that are not allowed. There's no demos.
Yeah.
Doom was a three-level demo that then you pay for. I guess you could have done it, but you would have to have an in-app purchase, and Apple would have taken 30%.
Exactly. So, I mean, it kind of grinds my gears on that point. I think Google is a lot less has a lot less of a defendable position on this, because their malware checking is just pathetically bad compared to Apple's. But, I mean, so, yeah, if you want to buy from the Apple App Store, then fine. You get a certain amount of security. But I do find it a little bit grinding that they can charge 30% on a game which was made popular with and they had nothing to do with, right, and which has been checked before.
And we should point out, it's not merely 30%. The game is free. The 30% isn't for
in-app
the game.
Purchases,
it's for costumes and other downloadable content, which Apple really had nothing to do with, right? They're giving away the game. So
ultimately, our feelings about what's right and wrong don't matter. Because the courts are going to look at precedent. Our policymakers are going to look at what makes sense right now based on how people are feeling about the election and everything else. And we don't have case law that defines a lot of digital IP yet.
Right.
The problem is that you can't preemptively make policy or regulation or case law until an event happens.
Honestly, though. Honestly, it's not our feelings. It's the judge's feelings. Because honestly, my first reaction is, well, it completely depends on what court gets this case.
Well, they're doing it in Northern District of California, which means a possibility that Coe's going to be in charge, and she knows her stuff.
She does. Lucy Coe is very good. So, and she's done a lot of antitrust stuff. So we mentioned that antitrust differs in the U.S. and the EU. My sense of it is that in the U.S., it's all about keeping companies competitive. It's to benefit innovation via allowing other companies to compete. And in the EU, it's a sense of protecting consumers more. Is that accurate? Is that a fair? Go ahead. Mike, why don't you do that? Because that really is your Bailey.
Yeah. I mean, there's another case that we might talk about later about what happened with Qualcomm, because that gets into this a little bit. But that was ruled in the Ninth Circuit this week. But generally speaking, you know, the American form of antitrust law over the last, you know, few decades has actually been to look for consumer harm. And that's been actually where a lot of the debate is lately, is whether or not that's appropriate or not. Whereas the EU looks at more of, is this company too big? And that's been really the dividing line. So a lot of the actions in the EU on antitrust have been, well, this company is too big and it's doing something that we feel is unfair because of its bigness. And
too
therefore
big
to,
is a so, terrible phrase. Really? They actually think that a company can be too big.
Yes.
Not an anti-competitive, just too big, too successful.
Right. So that's this is paraphrasing slightly, but that is effectively what they're saying, is that when those companies are too big, then they're leading to things that are, you know, in effect anti-competitive, but they're not necessarily having to show the anti-competitive nature, the anti-competitive impact of it. So
that's,
they're
practically
starting with
un-American.
I have to say, as a European, I have a comment on this.
Okay.
Because if a company gets too big, it becomes anti-competitive. Once you can dominate a market, I mean, we all know this. Once a company gets to the point where it can dominate a market because it has that many tendrils out there, there is an argument to say that companies can get too big. Efficient competition relies on allowing smaller competitors to enter the market.
But in the U.S., it's always been, if you're that big, it's only a bad thing. It's okay to be big. It's only a bad thing if you use your dominance in one market to enter another and dominate another market. That's the line you can't cross.
And to harm consumers in that process.
Right.
So that's part of it.
I think that's reasonable. So that says in the U.S., it's okay if you're a wildly successful company in one area. You just can't use that success to enter other markets.
Well, I mean, it sounds like a cute idea, but that's exactly what Facebook did, which is why they dominate 3/4 of the social media market right now. And same thing Cisco did in the 90s and noughties. You know,
but Apple is going to say, look, we only have, at best, 50% of the market. How can you say we're too big?
In the United States, a free market, there's a tension, and I think unresolvable tension, pitting a free market economy against our desire for there to be sort of infinite competition in the marketplace.
Oh, you're right. We believe in the Horatio Alger rags to riches. That's what we aim for.
That's right. And there is not a single, I would challenge everybody listening to see if you can think of one industry where ultimately there wasn't consolidation. There is always consolidation within the market for all of, you know, for many reasons.
But I would submit that that's what we should regulate, not the fact that such as somebody becomes big and successful. Google is dominant in search because they made a great product and no one else wanted to use the other one.
Or here's another way to think about it. You know, Amazon, I think of all of the different companies that are under the microscope right now, is going to have, it will be the hardest to prove a case against Amazon because there is Amazon.com, which is an online marketplace where you can buy stuff. There's AWS. There is the spatial mapping system for coal mines. There is the medical transcription service. I mean, Amazon has done an incredible job of being very diverse and not dominating any one particular market. They are not the biggest online retailer, not by far. They are not. They don't have market dominance in logistics. The value of Amazon is not any one individual business unit. It's the connections between all of them. Having all of these systems work together functions as a kind of continual level up. So most of the ire is usually directed at Amazon when we're talking about consolidation and, competition in the United States. The problem is it's going to be very hard to take them down. So we have to change I think we don't have the right language yet to really describe what it is that we're after, right? What we're after is, you know, fair practices and people not being kind of crappy and, you know, companies feeling like we can trust companies and that we don't start sort of with instant skepticism and that we feel okay using the tools. Facebook is an easier case. I think Apple and Google are slightly easier. Amazon is a totally different beast. And yet that's the company that everybody is kind of gunning for.
Yeah. The laws clearly need to be adapted to the 21st century. And we, before the laws can be adapted, we as a society need to have the debate and really think about what is it we want. I don't think Americans want to punish a company for becoming successful. That's kind of an antithetical to the kind of the magic, the dream.
Well, yes, but they don't want to be, they don't want to be screwed sideways by them either. I mean,
well, I'll put this in more personal terms. I don't think the billionaires should be allowed to exist. I think the marginal tax bracket should get to 90 or 95% after your first, say, $500 million.
And hey, it worked for America in the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and you did pretty well down there.
But I think if you propose that today, even though it's very clear that we have people who have, Jeff Bezos is a good example, so much wealth that it's bad for society. But if some candidate proposed that, I think they'd be shot down. I mean, I guess Elizabeth Warren did, and that was the end of that.
This is tricky because, I'm not trying to defend Amazon, but in the case of Bezos, you've got the money that that people say that you're worth on paper, and then you have actual spendable, liquidity.
Right.
And the problem is that that our government in the United States is not funding by any reasonable level. We are not funding basic research in science and technology. So we've sort of offloaded all of this to the private sector. And I find it difficult for us to criticize. And again, I'm not defending, certainly not defending past behavior, but like Elon Musk, Bezos, they are in a way self-funding with loopholes and taxes and everything else. But, they're building the next generation of the technology that will be needed for space.
Right.
We can argue about whether or not that's even necessary at this particular moment in time. But if we can't both say there shouldn't be lots, we can't both close the wealth gap, but while at the same time not reinvesting in the critical infrastructure that is our intellectual property in the United States.
It's so hard to have conversations like this now because our government is so far from being effective that this is such a pipe dream. You know, we would just like testing for COVID. Can we have that, please?
I mean, I'm sorry. I find it difficult to sympathize. Jeff Bezos gave an interview in Germany a couple of years ago where he was just like, I've got so much money, I'm putting it into space, and you know, that's what I'm going to do. At the meantime, the very people that pack his packages,
that make
into
him
packages
that
send it out,
money,
that make him that wealthy, are having to piss into bottles to avoid going over their quota. This is just insanity.
Yeah.
I mean, sorry, just show some respect to the people that made your money.
I totally agree. The point that I was actually trying to make, I agree with you. My point is, if we want wealth distribution to be more equal, I think we must also take, we must also devote significantly more resources into basic research and development, which we're not doing.
Oh, no, you on that.
If it's in the private sector versus the public sector, I'm not saying the federal government should do everything, but if most of what we're funneling out is into the private sector is market driven. So that is not the right, you know, you are motivating people to make choices that are not necessarily in the public's interest.
Right.
Oh, no, I mean, and this is why government is so good at this stuff. I mean, no private company would have funded research into TCIP or the internet,
right?
Because there's no profit in it. You need the government to do long-term pure research, and then companies take it and run with it. But no private company is going to do casting bread across the waters pure research because they can't justify it to shareholders. That's where government comes in, surely.
I agree.
Mike?
But in lieu of government...
Mike's trying to get a word in edgewise. I want to give Mike a chance. Just because he's wearing a blue wig, don't hold it against him.
I'm keeping it on. It's not going away.
You are brave.
And I'm sweating up a storm.
You can take it off. You don't have to wear it.
So anyway, back to the point that you were saying about the marginal tax rate, right? So there was just a couple of days ago, I saw that California was proposing to effectively boost the marginal tax rate on the wealthiest folks here. And there was all this talk of how all the successful Silicon Valley entrepreneurs are going to move out of California because it was going to, I think, you know, for the highest earners was going to push the marginal tax rate up to like 55% or something like that. Nowhere near the sort of 90-95% that was from you know, a few decades back. And so, you know, you have this issue of, you know, people will go elsewhere too if the tax rate is too high. And I think everybody's correct that there's two separate things to being talked about here. One is the sort of fundamental basic research, the R of the R&D, and then there's the D side of it. And we've now moved, you know, from a world where there was a ton of money going into R and less into D to a world that now everything is just focused on development.
Yeah.
And very little on the fundamental research.
Well, the other side of this
finding that balance is important.
Space is a bad example because we spend so little on space, almost shamefully. But
very shamefully.
But for instance, the amount of money Bill Gates puts into public health and vaccines is a tiny fraction of what governments can spend. So you can't expect, you can't put this on the private sector. They're just... Not only is it that it's market driven, that they're going to be development focused, there are all sorts of reasons, but it's also a tiny fraction of the kind of money government can spend. And I just think that that's abrogating your responsibility to say, well, let the private sector do it. I know that that's a popular current in American thinking right now, but I don't think it's right way to go.
Well, I mean, the private sorry, Mike, after you.
I was going to say, I mean, well, you know, again, getting to the difference between like the research and the development side of it, there's a difference between sort of core level infrastructure and everything above the infrastructure. And I think that there's a very strong argument for, you know, government funding of the infrastructure that makes everything else possible.
Yes.
And then allowing there to be tremendous competition.
Yes.
And let there be a free market and everything on top of that infrastructure.
That's how the internet should be run, for instance. Build the highways.
Exactly.
Let everybody else build on top of it. And you get competition, you get free enterprise, but you also get infrastructure that works.
Well, this is exactly what the South Koreans did. This is exactly what the Nordic nations did. They built the infrastructure and let it flow. You know, over here, it's private network, which is why Americans get screwed daily on their mobile phone and their telecoms charges, the rest of it, because it's an oligopoly. It's not free market competition. But yes, the government needs to fund the pure research. Companies need to develop it from there. I mean, if you look at most of the major, you know, even SpaceX wouldn't exist without NASA.
Yes.
Know, going forward on the way.
That's absolutely true.
Government seeds competition and private companies push forward, and it can work so long as companies don't get greedy.
So should Apple should Apple give up on this and just say, okay, here, we'll make Fortnite, I just don't see Apple saying, okay, we'll give you a deal 15%. I don't see that.
Everyone and his dog is then going to go to Apple and say, yeah, we want a special deal as well.
Too.
Yeah. You know, the legal department are going to
have lovely time.
Summer homes.
Maybe it's time. At this point, Apple, for the last 10-plus years, got to build the platform, use that money. Maybe it's time to say, you know what, 30% is too much now. It should be 15. I don't think it'd make everybody happy.
Nothing ever does, yeah. But no, I mean, it's honestly, they should cut individual deals for individual companies, and it's going to be a massive pain in the backside, but you know,
yeah.
It's, I don't honestly think with a game as popular as Fortnite, you can say we are adding 30% to the value of your game just by hosting it on our web store.
Yeah. All right, let's take a break. We have lots more to talk about. We got a great team dressed strangely, but that don't hold it against them. Mike Masnick of Tech Dirt, who was recently defunded, much like the Federalist. We'll talk about Google. It's an interesting conundrum.
That's one word for it.
Yeah. That's great to have you, Mike. Tech Dirt is a must read every single morning for me. TechDirt.com. And Mike also has his own podcast. We'll talk about that later. Ian Thompson, another must read, TheRegister.com now. No more of that silly.co.uk.
.co.uk still works.
I like saying that. When I was a kid, I subscribed to Punch, the British
magazine.
The British humor magazine. Even though I didn't get any of the, I mean, I don't even know who Edward Heath was, but it was fun, and I knew I liked the cartoons of his giant proboscis, and by the way, it was shipped on a slow boat because I would get it like 2 months later, but I liked it because it was kind of quirky and fun, and so that's why I like .co.uk. I don't know where I was going.
Yeah, I know. I miss it as well. But unfortunately, from an advertiser's perspective, when our sales guys were going out there, like, .co.uk, there's the door.
Yeah. What does that mean? Kook. It spells kook. Yeah. What are you talking? Believe me, try having a company named Twit. See how far you get.
Yeah, but you have the record which justifies it.
And then there's the fabulous Amy Webb, who is visiting us from the future today. She is a futurist, Future Today Institute. I feel so guilty I took my wig off because you're stuck. And it just doesn't seem right. But I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it anymore. But anyway, thank you.
Not as stuck as Ian is. I can take this off when we're done.
You actually, though, you look great. I mean, it's a really good look for you. Might consider this for future presentations.
Yes, I think when I go to my big meetings at the Pentagon, everybody will take me seriously. Even more seriously.
It's not worse than Shingy.
No, he is not a futurist.
What is Shingy?
That is a, I don't know, but he is not a trained, that there are people who call themselves futurists, and then there are people who have been trained in the methodology and the data and everything else, and these are different.
He calls himself the digital prophet.
Yes, I know. Well, I would never call myself that because I do modeling. I don't have an oracle or a magic ball or whatever. So,
hi, I'm a digital prophet. Nice to meet you.
But sadly, we now have similar hair. So there's
You know, if Shingy would just dye it purple, I think you two would really be. He's even got the glasses.
That'd be really awesome. That would be so great for me.
Come on, it's a great job title. It's like Parissa DeBriz in Google. She, her business cards are security princess, and it's just that's just a great job title to have.
Shingy has at times had kind of bluish hair, so it is conceivable. Our show today.
Thanks, Leo. Really, so glad I did.
I was going to say, you didn't say anything about my look and you, whether or not I should keep this look.
I thought that was your hair. What are you talking about? I thought that was Mike's look. He's blue.
My natural locks, yeah.
Our show today brought to you by WWT, Worldwide Technology, and their Advanced Technology Center, the ATC in St. Louis. We visited it last March. Seems like an eon ago. It was so cool. $500 million of equipment from the biggest enterprise companies, hundreds of OEMs, partners like the tech heavyweights of Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, HPE, and Intel, but also the little guys, the disruptors, the emerging companies like Equinix. It's really kind of amazing to walk down these aisles, rack after rack, filled with all the best stuff. What's that? Oh, that's cool. What's that? I loved it. What's cool is that the engineers at WWT, if I talked to them and they said, yeah, I said, you got the best job. They said, yeah, we get to play with everything. But they use it to create pilots, to spin up proofs of concept, to help WWT's enterprise customers understand what's new in technology, what technology they're going to use, how it integrates with their existing technology. It's pretty impressive. Companies stay with them for as long as a decade and more, because they know they can always go to WWT to get the answers they need to make sure their business is using the right technology to get the job done. Their Advanced Technology Center is an incubator for IT innovation. You get schedulable and on-demand labs like HPE's InfoSight Lab, along with hundreds of others, representing the latest advances in cloud-based machine learning to provide global insights into the status and health of infrastructure in one location and a whole lot more. You can do what the WWT engineers do in the ATC yourself. They're setting up these sandboxes, but this is new. They started this last summer. I love this. They offer their lab as a service, a dedicated lab space within the ATC where you, as a customer, can do your own programmatic testing using anything in this $500 million technology ecosystem. And because it's virtual, you don't have to go to St. Louis to use it. You can use it anywhere in the world 24/7. This is exactly the same stuff that the WWT engineers are using as they work every day beta testing new solutions built on the latest and greatest HPE technologies, building reference architectures, custom integrations to help their customers. It's really impressive. This is a company you will want to be with forever because they are going to help you get the job done. And it all starts by you going to WWT.com/twit, taking a look at this incredible ATC ecosystem. You get articles, case studies, all the tools you need to make a difference in today's fast-moving enterprise technology space, including those great hands-on labs. Learn why organizations across every industry, public and private, turn to WWT to guide them on their digital transformation. WWT.com/twit. Create that My WWT account. Get those resources at the ATC. You'll be blown away. It is. I learn more and more about this company all the time, and I'm amazed at all they do. WWT.com/twit. Worldwide Technology, delivering business and technology outcomes all around the world. Thank you, WWT. So what did happen with Google and you getting it? So this was, we talked last time you were on, in fact, Mike, about the Federalists saying, you know, the story that everybody published that you debunked, that the Federalist was being demonetized by Google. The theory was, oh, Google is against conservative thought and they're defunding us. But that's actually not the case. And now it's happened to you. This is automatic, yeah. Right?
Yeah. So they have these, you know, systems, these bots that go and are constantly monitoring different websites that have AdSense on it. And, you know, what we had written originally about the Federalist was that we had gotten similar notices, but we got them, you know, once every month or once every 2 or 3 months, we would suddenly get a notice from Google and was saying there's a problem on this particular article. And it was usually our comments, something in our comments that they didn't like and they didn't want their ads to appear next to it. And that's apparently what they had told the Federalist. And the Federalist turned into this big thing that Google was, you know, against them for their conservative viewpoints.
But that's always a concern for advertisers. With our advertisers too. They don't want to be in an environment that doesn't reflect well on them. So that's why it's difficult. YouTube's difficult. Twitter's difficult. And so it makes perfect sense that AdSense would be monitoring the pages that the ads are going to appear on. And if there's anything controversial, they'll say, okay, well, you're not going to get an ad until that goes away.
Right. Mike, what was it? Do you know what the content was?
Well, this is the problem. So what happened was 2 weeks ago, suddenly, instead of getting like one every 2 or 3 months, we started getting like 2 or 3 notices every day. You would have to, and there would be no information in the notice. You would have to log into the platform, and then it would give you very little information, but it would list out, you know, it kept changing. So somewhere between 20 and 30 URLs. Some, you know, were very, very old. Some didn't even exist. My favorite one was one that didn't even exist. If you clicked on it, it would just take you to the front page of TechDirt. My two favorites were the tag page for Google was deemed dangerous and derogatory. And so therefore they could not put ads on that. And then the second one, which felt somewhat ironic, was that the tag page for content moderation was also deemed dangerous or derogatory.
Is this kind of some sort of automated, like the content ID system on YouTube, some sort of automated thing that's just dumb and looks for keywords?
It sounds like there was maybe like an update sent, and it just, you know, bad code. You get garbage in, you get garbage out. Like, it seems like it was.
That's what I thought. And I had actually emailed some people at Google and said, hey, did something go haywire? Because suddenly, you know, now we were getting like 2 or 3 of these messages every day. And the list kept changing. We weren't doing anything. And so, like, you know, URLs that were bad would suddenly disappear from the list, and the new ones would appear, and there was no explanation for it. And so I said, you know, did something go haywire? And they said, nope, nothing's changed. And, you know, the feedback I got was basically like, we'll pass along your criticism to the teams about how to better communicate. And it's like, that doesn't help me. Then we just sort of kept getting, you know, angrier and angrier messages, whereas in the past, usually they would just say, you know, we just won't put ads on this page. And to us, we're like, fine, whatever. We don't get money for that page. No problem. But now they started putting these notices that said you must fix it. And then they told us if we weren't able to fix these things, and again, they weren't very clear as to what the problem was by the end of August, that they were going to cut us off. And then it just got worse and worse. And we just said, you know, forget it. I don't want to spend all my time dealing with this. So we pulled all the ads down. And so right now we have no ads on the site other than, you know, sort of house ads.
Yikes.
And we're trying to figure out what we're going to do about it. But, you know, right now we're not making advertising revenue. So
that's terrible. You really are defunded.
Well, but you're also, so you're not earning revenue, but they're not earning revenue either. So it seems like if this is happening across the board,
yeah, they don't want this.
There would be somebody within the organization looking around for broken code, is what it sounds like to me.
Well, but our experience of Google on this stage, they're relying totally on automated tools, and it's muck up central. It really is. Mike, sorry, I interrupted.
No, that's okay. I mean, you know, the thing is, that was my assumption too, is that they had code that had gone haywire, but we haven't heard other sites having the same sort of, you know, sudden rush of notices. And we've reached out to people at Google, and the response that we've gotten is that, no, this was an accurate thing. And so if you want to keep having the ads on your site, you have to fix it. And again, like, what do we fix?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so, like, you know, even in the cases where, you know, in some articles, like, I could figure out, like, yeah, sure, they probably don't like these particular comments. Or, you know, we had some articles about the George Floyd protests that were pretty angry because we think that's a situation worth being angry about. And they said that was shocking content. And so, like, okay, that's shocking content, but we're not going to change that just because Google doesn't like it. If they don't want to put ads on that page, fine. But, like, you know, things like the tag page for Google, what are we supposed to change on that? You know, I'm not going to be nice to Google just so that Google keeps the ads on the page. If that's the problem, yeah. I think that's a bigger deal. trying to influence our coverage. Like, hey, that's not cool.
Advertisers do that. You know, we sell our ads direct. We don't go through a service like Google AdSense. And we've had advertisers. We had an advertiser back in April say, well, we don't want to be on any content that mentions COVID-19.
You're not alone on that. We've had the same problem.
So we said, well, no, sorry.
Stuff that way.
Yeah, we won't let advertisers dictate editorial. I understand, though, advertisers are trying to avoid controversy. So, because their interest is pure commerce. They just want to sell a product. They don't want to get people mad at them. So I understand that. But why, for instance, did Google suddenly say that your newsletters, your daily emails are phishing?
Yeah, that was the other thing. That the exact same day that this started, all of our daily newsletters, which are just the literally like a snapshot of the day's blog sent out as an email, were put into phishing. And so for people who had G Suite, they were just automatically deleted. And you got a note saying, we're not showing you TechDirt's newsletter today because it was a phishing attempt. And for people who just had Gmail, it was put into spam with big red warning letter, you know, on top saying this is consistent with a phishing email. We're like, what? Where's the phishing aspect? We're not asking anyone to sign in. It's just a snapshot of a blog, you know, of all the stories of the day. And so,
Mike, I was just thinking, I wonder if there's a totally different issue, which is that you've been blacklisted. Like somebody blacklisted the domain. Somebody else who doesn't like either what you're writing or doesn't like you. Or
yeah, that's what I'm wondering. Is there community moderation? Are there tools of some kind?
That was some people said that, you know, and people were saying like maybe people were even like putting specific comments on the site in order to try and get us demonetized, which
that's what's happened before is the comment pages have brought you down.
Yeah.
Which is why a lot of publications have separate pages for content.
Well, there are plenty
and
of there's plenty of tools where you can list or get or delist URLs, domains, right?
Black hole them.
I just wonder if somebody's
out to get you.
Whatever reason. Yeah.
Or Google has decided that the word dirt should never appear on a page with advertising. I mean,
that's possible.
Will come.
That day will come.
it's possible. I mean, the thing, honestly, what would make this better, though, is if at least they would explain to us what the deal is, right? I mean, the only information that we get is, you know, this was deemed dangerous and derogatory, or this was deemed shocking. And it's like, well, how do we fix that? Right. And it's like, I'm not going to try and figure out how to make our page on Google not something that they find derogatory. Like, that's not worth it in any sense of the word. And so like
it's the kind of thing that would make Kafka just sorry.
Yeah. It's very Kafka-esque, isn't it? Yeah.
They probably don't know and they don't have a work stream or a unit set up to try to do like a reverse digital forensic investigation to figure it out. I mean,
content moderation is hard at scale.
Yeah.
And there's no bigger scale than Google and Facebook, right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is the thing, right? I mean, like one of the articles that early, like last year that we got in trouble for, the same thing was the article about not that it's hard at scale, that it's impossible to do well at scale. And the funny story was that we got that article deemed dangerous and derogatory too, where we were trying to explain why these things happen and why we understand why these things happen.
The first rule of content moderation is you don't talk about content moderation.
That seems to be the issue. And it's, it's funny. I mean, I find the whole thing somewhat ironic. I totally, like, I sympathize with Google being in this position because I recognize they're trying to, you know, they're trying to keep their advertisers happy. And I would bet that, you know, most of the sites where these things pop up and where people complain, you know, they probably are people who are doing bad things and trying to game the system. And so they have these processes in place. It's just that, you know, we happen to be one of the exceptions now.
I'm
where we got
so
caught.
Sorry.
I think we're pretty good actors, but they don't think
you
so.
You are very good actors.
Now we're in the market for different advertising solutions. We are exploring our options as we speak.
Yeah. No, it sounds like AdSense is not a long-term solution.
No, I mean, I know how you feel, Mike, because we're advertising driven the same way and we're still putting our content out for free, but I don't know. It's scary times over the next few years. We're going to have to see how this shakes out. But I don't honestly think that giving a company like Google that much control over your revenue flow, there's no way we can get around it, but there has to be a better way.
Well,
yeah, no, yeah. And look, I mean, we've been trying to explore different ways for a long time. And, you know, to be honest, like, you know, AdSense is, you know, it's not a huge part of our revenue stream because we've been exploring all different things. And right. so, like, losing them sucks, right? I mean, it's still a loss of revenue, but it is not, that is not 100% of our revenue. It's not even 50% of our revenue.
Oh, that's
but
good.
It is still, yeah. you know, it is still a certain amount of it that, that we would prefer that we had. And it wasn't a big zero. So,
yeah.
Yeah, that's, I mean, that's why we spent a lot of money, millions, really, building an inside sales, because it was, I wanted to control our own destiny, you know? But yeah. it's not, that's not tenable for a lot of people.
Yeah, no, we've tried that, and we haven't had much luck. Like,
it's hard.
We're in that dangerous spot where we're not quite big enough to really justify yeah. an inside sales force.
I married somebody who was very good at this. Choose your spouse wisely is my advice.
Yeah, Lisa is very good at that. Yeah, the problem is that this hits the independents hardest.
Yeah.
That, you know, if
exactly
you're
the voices you
hall,
want
fine.
Speaking.
But exactly. It's kind of, it's the outsiders. It's the edge people, the people that actually break the news rather than, you know, just follow the mainstream. And that's what makes this really disturbing. I mean, I read Tech Dirt Daily, and you do a great publication there. But yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this works out. And I hope it works out for the best for all of us.
I've always worried for Mike at Tech Dirt because you don't pull your punches. And when that guy, the email guy, sued you, I thought, oh, crap. But you've stood it. You stood there and, you fought the good fight. So everybody
yeah,
should go out and buy.
That guy was a complete wanker and he can sue me. It just, there's no way that was a justifiable
Ian,
lawsuit.
He won't sue you. He'll sue me. So stop.
Oh, I'm sorry. I just about all comment.
I don't know this guy. What the hell color is that mustache?
It was just.
No, I'm kidding. I'm just teasing. Uber and Lyft could have some problems in California this week. A judge ruled, no, your employees, your drivers are not contractors. They are employees, and you have to pay them as such. Both companies say they may actually suspend all operations in the state, but they are pushing a referendum ballot this November that would exempt them from AB 5. AB 5 has been a mixed bag. It was really targeted at these drivers specifically, but it hurt all gig workers, including a lot of our friends, independent freelance writers who can't work because they're Californians and companies won't hire them or won't give them work because of this really strict limitations in California on what constitutes contract work. They're limited on the number of articles they can write, for instance.
I've got to say, though, Uber and Lyft's statements have been kind of like, nice rideshare service you had there. Shame if something was going to happen to it.
Yeah.
I mean, they're basically saying, we will lock you out unless you do what we say. And that's not how democracy works. So I can understand.
They're not just doing that. They're trying to change the law in November. They've got a referendum.
They've got Prop 22 going through the law. Yeah, and they're pushing it to all their customers. I've been getting the you know,
there's ads
as well.
They've been running a lot of ads. Have you seen the ads? You know, I'm a mother of four, and the only way I can make a living is by delivering groceries every third day or whatever. And it makes you, they tug at the heartstrings. And I don't know how I feel about this. I understand. And the IRS has always had strict rules about who can be, a lot of companies use contract employees to avoid paying benefits and other expenses. Mm-hmm. And they do it, in effect, as a way to dodge treating the employee properly. And I understand that's what AB 5 is trying to take care of. But at the same time, I also, nowadays, I know a lot of gig workers. And it's hard for them. You know, all you are gainfully employed, but I know a lot of the people we have on these shows are hurt by this law. So
But this law doesn't think about the long term. So, yes, something needs to be done to provide better services for the people who are contract workers. But this referendum on Uber and Lyft has very long term consequences for the state of California. Katie Binley in the Wall Street Journal, the Weekend Journal, has a huge story about tech migration and people, because of the virus, choosing to live somewhere else. And then just, you know, if you're working from home, you can work from home anywhere. It doesn't have to be California. But if you're in a situation where you're a contract worker and there's lingering economic recession and the virus is protracted, California stands, I think, to, you know, one of the unintended consequences of trying to get people better benefits is that you drive revenue out of the state.
There's a great illustration on that article of a Model 3 Tesla going across the Golden Gate Bridge, just like the Jodes leaving Oklahoma with all their stuff on the roof.
I agree that something should be done, but this is so, like, the problem with every government is that there's no planning. There's no long-term planning in place. So this addresses an existing problem without thinking through the next order impacts and how you could wind up, you know, it's all coming from a very good place, but you could wind up with serious problems on the other side.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, I think that part of the thing with AB5 was just that it assumes that everyone who is a contractor or a freelancer or a gig worker wants it to be a full-time job.
Right.
And I think for those who actually do want that, then there's benefits there. But for a huge number of those people, they actually don't want it to be a full-time job. They like the flexibility. They like the ability to have it be like an additional income or to, you know, be able to change things up or to make their own hours and things like that. And AB5 doesn't take that into account. And you know, certainly in the journalism space, the number of freelancers in California, I know a bunch of them certainly, who are all suffering because of this law, and they're saying, you know, we never want it to be full time. I don't want to be tied to a particular publication, which is probably going to go out of business soon anyways.
Right.
You know, I want to be able to bounce around. And so, you know, and I think that they're, you know, people say it's very cynical that Uber and Lyft have been pushing for sort of like a third option between freelance contractor and full time employee. But when you look at it, there's actually, it makes sense. Like, there should be something different because it is a different type of work. And, you know, you want there to be, you know, some sort of safety net for them in terms of doing their job. But saying that it has to be a full-time employee or you know, a fully benefited employee is not necessarily the right answer. So figuring out something in between would be good, but that's not what the California legislature has done.
I talk to a lot of really unhappy Uber and Lyft drivers. Not lately. Before COVID, there weren't a lot of them that were thrilled with the way they were still doing it. So obviously, it somewhat worked for them. But do you think Uber and Lyft take advantage of their drivers?
Yes,
they do.
I mean, I'm sorry. Uber and Lyft's business model does not work unless you can pay less than full time wages.
Their whole model is actually ultimately based on not having drivers at all. Right?
Well, and also there was that horrible rental model where they were trying to get people to upgrade to black cars, but do the financing through them, which was horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible.
Yeah.
Worse than a taxi, though. Taxi drivers kind of get a rough
deal. The medallion system in New York is part of the reason why Uber was able to grow because that was, again, lack of planning.
Yeah.
They never issued more medallions. As somebody who's in New York,
intentionally limited them. That was intentional.
Right. And it became absolutely untenable. So just before the virus, you had 100,000 Uber drivers crowding the streets of the boroughs, many of them in Manhattan.
Yep.
You know, also was bad. But the whole thing, again, a lot of our current problems are the result of nobody thinking through the next order impacts,
right,
and having the wherewithal to make short term decisions that benefit the longer term versus cause risk and harm.
And we really reward that. I mean, both Lyft and Uber have had huge rewards to the founders. It's been, you know,
the thing that I don't fully understand that Uber and Lyft haven't done that I think they might have been in a better position if they had done is make it a real marketplace where let the drivers effectively set their prices as well, and then let Uber and Lyft sort of match, you know, prices based on what customers are looking for and what drivers are willing to accept. Instead, like, basically they're doing everything. Uber and Lyft are setting everything, including exactly what the price is. And therefore, it's harder to call them a true marketplace. If they had set it up as a real marketplace, then I think they would have a stronger argument here than, you know, the
I don't know about Lyft, but I know Uber subsidizes 41 cents on the dollar for every ride. So there's not a lot of it's not exactly a flexible pricing model. I
mean, they're doing that for a reason, because they want to dominate the market. And once they've got oligopoly monopoly control,
they put those then they can cabbies jack the prices out of business. Up. Yeah, yeah.
But their business model doesn't work unless they can pay less than taxi driver. And I'm with you, Amy. The taxi system in the US, and I spoke to a VC, and he goes, "You want to know why Uber really took off in SF? Because SF taxi drivers are amongst the worst in the world for screwing you over." And I can understand that totally. But I'm sorry, if someone's working 60 hours a day for Uber, sorry, 60 hours a week for Uber, they are a full-time employee and they should be treated as such.
Is part of the problem in this country that we don't have national health care? I mean, we're seeing right now a huge problem because for most Americans, their health care is tied to their employment. And when you're out of work, you're out of health care at the same time. And that really is what all of this AB 5 is about, is not paying those benefits to those workers because they're contractors, so I don't have to pay health.
So, I'm going to say, Amy.
Oh, go ahead, Ian.
Okay, I've got to say, as a European, it is shocking, really shocking, quite how bad things were. I had no idea until I moved out here. You've got student loans, you've got medical insurance. It's basically economic serfdom, as far as I can see. If you don't have a job, you can't pay off your loans, you can't pay off your medical care. If you've got a family, you know, I mean, this is just killing innovation in this country. If you've got a family, you're not going to go it alone and make your own startup because you can't afford the healthcare costs. So, you know, there is an argument that, you know, Microsoft and Apple kicked off because they were started by kids in their 20s who didn't have families to look after. But if you've got a family, if you've got a serious medical condition, you can't afford to lose your job. It's massively harming towards innovation, and it's killing America at this point. I'm sorry.
I completely agree with you. So my company has several employees, and a couple of years ago, I thought this is insane that if for some reason we part ways, you know, that their insurance is going to go away. So I tried to convert the entire company over to a system where we would cover everybody's insurance, the whole thing, and really good insurance, but that it was in their name. So what I tried to do was buy everybody their own, and we have employees in many different states and also in Canada. So I tried to buy different policies. It was so onerous and so that they could keep them.
Yep.
Yes. The whole process was so ridiculously hard that and it wasn't clear whether or not they were going to get the benefits that I knew we could get through a company plan. I finally just gave up.
Yeah.
We still pay for all of we cover all of their benefits. But the problem remains that they, you know, they can't really take all of that with them. And it's expensive. My per employee insurance rates are, you know, very, very expensive. Close to $1,000. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's very expensive.
We're in the same boat, basically. I mean, we have employees all over and also Canada, though Canada is a little bit different because they do have universal health care.
Right.
Fine. But payroll is a separate issue.
But for the employees in the States, it is a challenge. And of course, we do the same thing where we want to provide them, you know, really good health care. But it's, you know, doing that in a way that is sensible. I think, you know, honestly, it's a parallel to what we were talking about earlier with this idea of, like, you know, infrastructure, right? To me, healthcare to some extent is infrastructure, right? If you can provide a base level of healthcare to everyone, like, you need that for everything else that happens in the economy and everything else that happens in the world. You shouldn't have people worrying about that in order to do everything else that they need to do to make the economy run.
Two stories. One from our chat room. L. Rich says, my company decided to fire 500 people. They fired people from the Mountain View, California office instead of the Toronto office because the Toronto people were cheaper. They don't have to pay health care. And then our friend Renee Ritchie, who left iMore, left his full-time job with which would have paid benefits, except he's in Quebec and he was able to start his own YouTube channel because he didn't have to worry about that. So there is definitely a burden, an innovation burden.
Well, I mean, we have the same problem with the reg. I mean, we had a situation before COVID kicked in where we were looking to expand our journalist headcount. And it was honestly, it was simple economics. For the amount of healthcare costs we'd have to pay in the US, we could employ two journalists in the UK where they have a national health care system.
Right.
So it was just logical. We would love to hire more US journalists, but given the excess costs that are going on there and the fact that health companies have to show like a 5 or 6% growth rate every year, which means prices get jacked up, we're not going to employ in the US under the system.
That's why this show, there's a Brit and two aliens, because I don't have to pay you guys health care at all. That's a joke. We're going to take a little break, come back. Microsoft announced a new phone, but it's not a phone, but it's sort of a phone, but I don't know if it's a phone. And the reaction we're seeing from the tech blogs is very interesting. We'll talk about that and a lot more. Amy Webb is here from the Future Today Institute, futuretodayinstitute.com. Ian Thompson from the Register.com. Mike Masnick from TechDirt.com. Always a pleasure having you guys. We were going to have a little Fortnite fight, but we decided not to. I'll get this camera yet. Now I'm out of ammo. Our show
you need Lee Metford 330 for decent aiming.
I have to calibrate the sights on this Nerf pistol. When we moved into the brick house many moons ago, I guess almost 10 years ago, I had this crazy idea because we had this giant 10,000 square foot basement that at the time was completely empty. We eventually filled it with crap, but at the time was completely empty. And I bought like 20 Nerf guns. I thought we'd have a great big battle. This is the last one left. I don't know where they've all gone to. Our show today brought to you by Wasabi Hot Cloud Storage. I think this is amazing, but I wish more people knew about it. Everybody knows about Amazon S3. What if I told you there was something that was compatible with the S3 API, but was 80% cheaper, didn't charge for egress, didn't have all those crazy tiers, that was even faster than S3, provided 11 nines of durability? Wouldn't you be interested? But everybody talks about, Amazon, Google, the cloud's got to be Microsoft. It's Wasabi. Wasabi's disruptive price performance model is putting everything, it's upending people's storage plans. Wasabi is actually less than on-prem storage, less than just the annual cost for maintenance fees on on-prem storage. That's how much you save with the Wasabi. It is a fantastic way. And if you know you're going to be creating a lot of data, most companies do, we're going to have a terabyte a week or whatever. Wasabi is a great choice. Just compare that to the cost of on-prem storage. Your boss might say, well, on-prem, we know it's safer, it's secure. No. Wasabi's 11 nines of durability. They're hosted in premier tier 4 data centers that are not only fully secure, but they're fully redundant. They do active integrity checking. All objects stored on Wasabi servers are checked for integrity every 90 days. And because they're on redundant network centers, if there's one bit off, you can restore it and you never lost a bit. That's how you get 11 nines of durability. It's secure by default. Everything stored in the Wasabi cloud is always encrypted at rest, even if you don't specify it. Of course, they follow all the industry's best security models and design practices. You've got access control mechanisms, bucket policies, ACLs. One of my favorite things, and it's great if you're reading about Garmin and all the people being hit by ransomware, you will love this. Your data in the cloud can be immutable. You can say, this can't be changed. It cannot be erased. It cannot be altered either by malware, hackers, fumble-fingered employees. Your data is safe. Wasabi is highly secure, disruptive technology that's turning its industry on its ear. 80% cheaper, 6 times faster than Amazon S3. And now there are two ways to go. There's flat fee, very affordable, or you can pay one time and get reserved capacity storage. This is for companies that know we're going to be using a certain amount of storage every week, every month, every year. So what you do is you reserve it with Wasabi ahead of time. It's just like you would buy storage ahead of time. You're not going to buy the hard drive the minute you need it. You buy it ahead of time. You buy reserve the capacity with Wasabi for 1, 3, or 5 year increments. The more you reserve, the longer the term, the more you'll save. You can save a lot. Like I said, it's significantly less than on-prem storage. It's less than the annual cost of maintenance fees for on-prem storage. Wasabi is just a no-brainer. And if you're a managed service provider and you sell, you resell this stuff, you're gonna love it because you can sell it at a lower cost and still make more money. Everybody wins with Wasabi. Calculate the savings for yourself. You can start a free trial right now for 1 month. Go to wasabi.com, click the free trial link, enter the code TWIT. Play with it, bang on it, mess with it. I think you'll see, really. But since it uses the S3 API, all your tools already work. Join the movement. Migrate your data to the cloud and do it with confidence. WASABI.com. Look, everybody's using more and more storage. Wasabi's the place to do it. Wasabi.com. Use the offer code TWIT. Hey, before we go on, we had a fun week this week on TWIT, and I understand a small movie has been made to demonstrate. Watch. Steve Wozniak is celebrating a birthday.
Woz has got everything you could ever want, including honorary doctoral degrees.
Thank you, Jonathan Mann, the song a day man.
Previously on TWIT. All about Android.
You've been considering waiting for the 4A. It gets most of the things right that it really needed to land. The camera's great. It's svelte. It's light.
Windows Weekly.
The duo's here!
Despite the fact that every other form factor they've tried has not succeeded, they did do it once with the Surface Pro, and they clearly want to do it again, and they're making this bet for some reason on a dual-screen device.
Tech News Weekly.
Harry McCracken from Fast Company, he has the new Surface Duo device.
It's quite wide, like I couldn't put it in my shirt pocket, and it is really thin, thinner than other smartphones.
Mac Break Weekly.
This iMac has got way better AMD graphics, a way better camera, but that nanotexture display, it is the best screen I have ever seen.
But how do you not touch it?
That screen alone.
I know, right?
I will touch it.
Apple says they are not going to allow xCloud or Stadia on iOS.
Here's a moment where the world is really going to like tidal wave their opinions on this.
Live update, Epic's Fortnite has been removed from the App Store after they implemented direct payments.
Today, Epic Games took the unfortunate step of violating the App Store guidelines that are applied equally to every developer and designed to keep the store safe for our users.
If you missed TWIT this week, you missed a lot.
I know, right?
I am nuts. I admit it. I woke up Wednesday morning. I saw at 6 a.m. Microsoft selling a new phone. I rushed out, laid down my $1,400. And bought a Surface Duo. Then I read all the articles saying, oh, this is a terrible idea. I thought it was a great idea. Any thoughts? Was I nuts? It looks like a little Moleskine notebook, two screens. I was going to buy the Galaxy Fold. I thought, why fold it in half? Just have a hinge, two screens. The software works so that you can move stuff. You have two Android apps running. The other thing I think is interesting, it's for the first time ever, Microsoft, which normally provides operating systems to OEMs who build hardware, for the first time ever, Microsoft is an OEM building hardware based on Google's software, somebody else's operating system. It's their first Android device. I think it's very interesting. And I think it could be a form factor that could change things. Am I nuts, Amy?
Well, did you ever play with, I'm sure you did, the Windows phone a billion years ago?
Oh, those were awful, though. Those were terrible.
Which Windows phone?
No, Windows Phone 7 and 8, the new one with the tiles, I like that.
The tiles. It had the tiles.
Oh, you're not talking about the old Windows CE.
No.
I thought that was good.
I actually thought that the phone was, and I can't remember which operating system it was, but the hardware was pretty nice. It was sleek.
The Nokia's, yeah.
Oh, the Nokia cameras are fantastic.
40 megapixel cameras.
Right. Yeah. It was a good
they were
phone.
Great. The operating system looked was
I don't even think the stuff. No. I don't even think the I think Microsoft did something really interesting. They sat back while Google and Apple went crazy with mobile, and they looked, they said, okay, we could do something better, and they did make something better. But by then they were way in the back. And Google and Apple were miles ahead of them, and it was hopeless.
So full disclosure, I've advised Microsoft on and off for many years. I continue to think that in a lot of areas, Microsoft has superior code, has superior products.
Not Windows.
The problem is making decisions internally and getting it to market. So where is the value network? Where is the ecosystem of the developers and the people and the processes and the work streams and the apps and the, you know what I mean? It's just, I think at some point you have to also invest in really developing and getting excited, getting that, that entire ecosystem.
Let me make the case. Let me pretend that I'm Satya Nadella or Panos Panay who's in charge of devices. Let me make the case. People, the world is changing clearly, right? The idea of a PC on your desk, mobile completely blew that out of the water, right? This is Microsoft's business. In fact, for the first time ever, I was looking at Microsoft's quarterly, or actually it was the yearly results, and Azure was the biggest moneymaker. Then there was Windows, then there was Office, then there was a bunch of other stuff. Those lines have completely crossed. Microsoft is a cloud company now. And I wonder really how much longer they care that much about Office and Windows. So what I think is that they're thinking, Nadella comes from the Azure division, they're thinking, look, devices aren't going to matter so much. Nobody's going to say, I have to run Windows. It doesn't matter. I can run a Chromebook. I can run an iPad. I can run anything I want. I need a window to the cloud. What does matter is form factor. And what Microsoft is desperately trying to figure out is what are these thin clients? We know our business is going to be selling software as a service and operating systems as a service. What are the clients going to be, and how can we have a part of that market as well? And so it makes sense for me for them to release something that is a complete it's not a slab of glass. It's a unique way of looking at it.
It still relies on parts from other places around the world.
Well, that's right? True.
But this could potentially be a challenge going forward.
Well, who's going to make anything nowadays if you do that, if you say that? I'm not going to make any hardware. I can't make a refrigerator.
Well, I've got to say, I'm
going to make it in Muncie. Where am I going to make it?
I mean, I've got to say, I do kind of like Microsoft's approach to this, in that they've eschewed they've got rid of the whole folding screen business, because I still don't think the technology is there on that.
Yeah, that's clearly bad.
Doing the dual screen, I think, is going to pay benefits, but it's Microsoft. They're not exactly innovators. They are developers rather than innovators.
Well, that's why I thought this was interesting, because you're right. I mean, I wasn't very impressed with any of the Surface stuff. And I'm not a Windows fan. I don't like Windows. But I think this idea of two screens, it's small enough to put in your pocket, but it opens up to an 8-inch, kind of like a tablet, is kind of interesting.
If they can get the scrolling between the two to work fine.
It looks pretty good.
That would actually work fairly well. I've never yet seen a foldable screen which would last more than 6 months to a year.
And but the screen's not folding. The screen's not folding.
Yeah,
that's the beauty
exactly.
of this.
This is why they've done the smart thing by doing two separate screens. Samsung and the rest of them can go for this folding screen, but I don't honestly think it's going to work.
I feel like I feel like I saw an HTC phone. I used to live in Hong Kong, and I was going back and forth a bunch. I feel like I saw HTC or somebody else had a dual screen, so you had to flip the phone around, but it was you doubled
LG,
the real
estate. LG has a dual screen. No, you're right. This has been around. In fact, remember when you lived in Japan and those big kind of weird phones that were really they had flipped, but they had two. They would. This is not new.
Now I'm kind of. I keep wondering when sort of. I'm surprised we haven't seen more work in scrolling surfaces, more like an e-ink versus a traditional screen that's now just bigger and two hinged together for certain purposes. I think we're headed to an ecosystem where we've got more diversification of devices for a while, where we've got a lot of experimentation in different types of...
That's one of the things I kind of wanted to celebrate, yeah. The last thing I want to do is buy another glass slab.
Right, not scroll. I meant retractable. So like picture a pen that you can retract a screen in, out of. There's functionality there. It's not as pretty or glitzy, but...
This is kind of pretty, I think.
Sure, it's pretty. Yeah. You going to use it?
Yeah,
I think so. Even if I just use it as a really, really expensive Kindle.
Hmm.
I love the idea that you could Amazon did the Kindle software so that you could. The other thing is because it's got a 360 hinge, And so you could use it like, look at that. Is now, wait a minute. Let me just go back and show you this. This is the...
That page flip was...
Yes. That's a Kindle version. It's like a little book.
Yeah, yeah, that is the puppy's packet. I mean, you've got the good scrolling system going through. But honestly, I miss e-ink. I mean, the
e-ink
battery life
sucks.
Oh, come on. The battery life you got
like
from
15 years ago.
Great.
I have all the latest Kindles. I have the Amazon Oasis and all that. It still sucks.
It's flexible, though. So the don't conflate e-ink with the device that Amazon
built. Oh, okay.
Right? E-ink itself is actually pretty slick, and it can fold and bend and coil.
I don't know if I really want a roll-up screen in my pocket, like a little scroll that I open up like this and then close.
Imagine a future. See, you don't want that now, but imagine a near future in which you are wearing most of the devices. So you've got sort of dumb smart glasses
or some smart glasses,
an earpiece. Right. And that is just sort of the last mile of information and the infrastructure supporting content. So like a pen that you would, you know, sort of.
Sad. I bought this thing and everybody said it's dead on arrival and I got talked out of it. But that's okay. Mike, you want to weigh in at all on this?
I mean, I think I agree with everything that everybody said. It's a neat design. I can understand the impulse buy if you have $1,400 sitting in your pocket.
I make my wife buy these things. I don't.
I don't know that it will get that much use or that the setup, as neat as it looks and as wonderful as that commercial looks, like how useful is this and how much are you going to turn to this device over existing devices? And I think Amy's right that there's a lot more like really interesting stuff coming down the road very soon. So even if this is nice, you know, a few years from now, people are going to.
It's the first. I understand that. It's the first. I think, you know, I was about to buy the new Galaxy Fold. So in that respect, I think I've saved a little bit of money and brain cells. I do have an entire cabinet of devices that seemed really cool when I bought them and no longer have any use at all. But
seriously, Leo, I would love to get access to your cabinet of devices as well.
Awesome.
Because you buy everything and it's great.
This is what you should do. Well, partly it's part of the job, right? So I can write it off. But I mostly nowadays I don't want to buy. Like I'm not going to buy the Samsung Note, the new Note 20, which they announced, because it's so much like the Note 10, which I already have. I don't see any reason. But when I do see a new form factor or an attempt to do something out of the box, I kind of want to try it and get it. And I did think that folding phones were kind of interesting. I think there's a real problem because it's still not a glass screen; it's a plastic screen ultimately. That's not a good experience.
What heat would be like if you're using it for many, many hours in weather that's not chilly? I wonder.
Well, I'll find out, won't I? Because it's hotter than hell right now. We are having a heat wave.
Oh, tell me about it. I'm sitting in my back room at the moment, just like I've got ice packs around my stomach.
Well, I didn't want to say anything, but your blue mustache is turning into blue lip gloss. I didn't want to say anything, but it's...
No, I know. I should. It's green, but no, it's just terrible.
It's kind of melting onto your face. I wasn't going to say anything, but let's take a little break. I thought the Duo would be interesting. We'll find out. It comes out September 10th. It is a little high-priced, and as many people pointed out, it doesn't have any of the attributes of a phone. No NFC. It has not waterproof. It doesn't have wireless charging. The camera is mediocre at best. And it's $1,400. So I'm probably just a sucker. But I want to see news. I want to see news. Believe me, Amy Webb, I will be the first in line to buy augmented reality spectacles when Apple ships those. You know.
My husband's been writing prescriptions for Amazon glasses for the Echo. Echo, whatever they're called. Yeah, he's written two scripts.
Really?
And every time he's like, hey, what are you going to do with these things? Why are you getting them?
Yeah, these don't seem that interesting because really it's just
they're dumb glasses.
Echo and glasses, right?
They're actually, it's a brilliant brilliant move, I think, by Amazon, because there is no camera. The lenses are not, there's no digital layer. It just allows you to talk to Alexa, but it's a clever, slow on-ramp to right. a world in which we are wearing more technology. And especially after what happened with Google Glass, you know, a pair of kind of like glasses that are somewhat impractical, but you can talk to, but don't have any of the creepy factor that people were concerned about with Glass, acclimates
it's
folks.
Really, all this is earbuds built in the glasses, though.
Sure. But it's also then getting, you know, I think, so I've worn glasses since I was 4. I've got no problem.
Yeah, me too.
More of a problem wearing contacts at this point than glasses.
Right.
But if you're not used to wearing glasses, right, you're asking people to jump through some hurdles. So I think what Amazon is doing is actually pretty clever.
When are we going to get the glasses that you described on that show, First Man, which I really liked, and I'm sorry that that didn't get picked up, but the idea was the first people going to Mars.
Yeah.
And I know you were a consultant for it. In fact, I watched it because I knew you were a consultant for it. And one of the things I really loved about it was everybody in the show was wearing what looked like normal spectacles, but they could share, like you could swipe video from yours to another person's. So people would say, hey, watch this. And they would swipe it over. They would be watching something, you know, you could see their eyes. You didn't know they were watching something. They kind of, and I thought, that's what I want. That's exactly what I want. I want augmented right. reality. When am I going to get that?
So that show is set in the year 2031, and we worked on all of the technology that's in the show. You know, everybody, there's so many patents. There's so much IP. There's so much development in glasses. There's a couple of hurdles. One is getting enough coverage, wireless coverage, to make them work, because part of what makes them work is sort of spatial computing. Two is getting people used to the idea of wearing normal looking glasses. And I think for people who prefer contacts, it's going to be a little bit of a leap to get them to start wearing glasses again. And then it's getting them made. I don't think you can underestimate the geopolitical tensions right now between the United States and China.
You brought that before. So nobody should announce a new product that's not built in the U.S.?
I know that a lot of companies are now trying to create manufacturing plants and factories to build things and build components in the United States. Whether or not that scales.
I mean, that's a good thing if it works.
It's a good thing if it doesn't have a trickle-down effect of driving up the prices on everything.
Well, the price will go up.
Subsidizes.
Right.
Right. So then we have a bigger wealth divide and technological divide than we have right now, which is not a good thing.
Yeah.
But to answer your question about glasses, we're probably another, 2020? We're probably another decade away. But it's not like there's going to be a switch that flips and suddenly everybody's got the glasses. It's a transition. So we will start. You know, it's and that transition is probably a little bit protracted now because of the virus. And
do you think, even though there's a potential that the administration will change in January and perhaps we'll, I don't know if we'll warm up to China, but maybe we'll have a more strategic relationship with China, you think there's still a cause for concern?
So part of the problem in the United States is that there's the old guard. And what its posture was toward China, which was sort of frenemy,
right.
which I think in some ways was good, but also sort of failed to recognize China as a growing diplomatic, economic, and militaristic pacing threat.
That's what Ben Thompson says, too. He says, we're not acknowledging what China really is after.
Right. So the problem is, once you make that acknowledgement, there is a new set of tensions that are created, and it's a little difficult to acknowledge China as a militaristic pacing threat, which would be a big deal in the United States. And then to say, but we're going to just placate at this point. The sort of the script that the military runs by doesn't allow for that.
Am I hopelessly naive to believe that the best hope for world peace is free trade, that a country that is a trading partner, even if we don't agree with what they're doing to the Uyghur Muslims, which is horrific, that it's safer, it's a safer world if we're economically dependent on each other than if we have barriers and walls up? Is that hopelessly naive?
Well, I think that was the idea.
Yeah, that's the old way.
China has a growing, we're going to see the largest growth of a middle class than ever before seen in human history. So China's biggest problem is food scarcity. It's making sure all of these people are fed, and that as this economic transition happens, that there's not a huge uprising. So China's legitimately worried about a lot of things. But to answer your question,
well, they had a massive famine under Mao. There was no uprising. Tens of millions, hundreds of millions of people died due to poor planning and poor policy from the central government, but it didn't cause a revolution.
No, but China's also positioned differently now. I know we're super far off topic, but China's been quietly moving into emerging markets. And if you're at all interested in the forefront of mobile, Africa's a really good place to look because they've leapfrogged a lot of other places in the world. So you've got all of this emerging critical infrastructure, all of these new markets, all of this emerging work that's been happening with China at the helm, with their infrastructure and, you know, their technology being used. And when I started talking 5 or 6 years ago about a bifurcation of our digital, like a splinter net, right? A bifurcation of how our digital systems work. Everybody was like, well, who cares? It's just China. It's just Africa. And, you know, now here we are in the year 2020.
Yeah, we got to care.
And, you know, so if there's a transition, I think what we have is probably a smarter, quieter approach and hopefully a lot less grandstanding and taunting in a public space, which is not.
That's clear. I mean, look, that's clearly unproductive. And you're right. If we thought this is going to go on for another 4 years, I would probably want to build a factory in the U.S. too. I understand that.
Yeah, but like this is all kind of important because as everybody starts suddenly now waking up to the idea that there's a company called Tencent, which is
hold that thought. Hold that thought. I do want to talk about TikTok and Tencent. There's a new plan with TikTok, by the way, because it's a new week. New week, new plan. But we'll talk about that. And I do want to talk about Tencent and what is going on. And then I will mention this because I know, Mike Masnick, you're very interested in what's happening to the Postal Service this week. They're taking out millions of dollars worth of equipment. It's just announced that the House is going to return to do something about that. They're going to cut their summer recess short to consider legislation to protect the Postal Service. And I know that was something you were interested in, Mike. So I'll just mention that. That just came across the wire. But let's take a little break. Got to do it. I'm sorry, because I want to talk about the fine people who built this studio, the LastPass studio. We're here thanks to LastPass. They're keeping the lights on. And frankly, they're keeping our software, our passwords, our users secure. Thank you, LastPass. But now with this work from home thing, you know, this is our IT already had a big challenge. Now you got a remote workforce. LastPass surveyed global IT decision makers, almost all of them, 96% of them said, yeah, the remote workforce changes everything when it comes to identity and access management. How can you manage identities, promote good security behaviors when your employees are at home in their gym jams? You can with LastPass. I'm so glad. I'm so relieved. I've been using LastPass personally for 12 years, but we started using LastPass Enterprise about 5 or 6 years ago, and thank goodness, because with LastPass, our employees can go home, but we still have the security. They've got the keys to the kingdom. They're taking them home, the keys to our bank accounts, our websites, our databases, our QuickBooks, everything. But we don't give up centralized control. We don't give up an IT dashboard that lets us know exactly who's using what, when, and where. And that's so important to securing our stuff and your stuff, right? Of course, it starts with the password vault. Every employee gets their own vault for storing every app and web login they use. They love this, by the way, because it's automatic. You know, the first thing I install when I get a new phone, when I get this new Duo, put LastPass on there. And when I add other apps, log into websites, LastPass fills it in. It's so much easier. So much easier. It's also important because it makes password sharing easier. It's one thing when you're all in the office together, but password sharing, you don't want them sending texts with the log into your bank account. LastPass does it securely right in LastPass, so your corporate data is safe. You get enforceable policies. We always, for instance, insist that people use two-factor with LastPass. We could turn that on. We have minimum password requirements. You also get easy user management. We can add and remove users automatically. You can even do it with the directory integration. So if you're already using LDAP or something like that, it can just automatically happen. I think LastPass is critical to managing a business that's distributed, and now all businesses are. When user identities are centrally and securely managed, a business can ensure the correct employee is doing the right thing and has the right access. That's why you need LastPass. They love it. They'll work more efficiently when they can access the data and resources they need easily. You'll love it because LastPass's IAM solutions help businesses improve the employee experience and safeguard from cyber threats. Let your remote workforce focus on the work they need to do without compromising your security. Secure your remote workforce with LastPass, LastPass.com/twit to learn more. LastPass.com/twit to learn more. So, TikTok, the latest is, does this supersede the previous? I'm very confused. There's a new executive order ordering ByteDance to divest from its U.S. TikTok business within 90 days. Effectively, I think that extends the deadline from September to 90 days from now, right?
Right. That changes at 45 days. I don't know what preceded it, but
I think the idea was, Microsoft will buy it, and then if they don't, then at September 20th, it's all over. That's, right. I guess, superseded. I don't know. But under the new order, ByteDance is ordered to destroy all its copies of data attached to U.S. users and inform CFIUS, the Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, when it has done so.
Right. Good luck enforcing that.
Yeah. It's all gone. It's deleted.
This is just insane. When you look at the amount of data that Google or Facebook apps take, it's no different from TikTok. Basically, Trump has got a piece of ginger up his backside over the fact that
TikTok... No, wait a minute. He says, there is... I'm not going to do the imitation. I can't. There is credible evidence that leads me to believe that ByteDance... Get this. Quote, might take action that threatens to impair the national security of the United States.
Uh-huh. Right. This was the guy defunding the United States Postal Service.
Yeah, but what could TikTok do to impair our national security?
It could stop a kids lot. From dancing.
All right. Now, wait a minute. Amy says a lot. What could they do?
So TikTok is...
They could throw the election at Joe Biden.
This is not... I would be more worried about the Russians than the Chinese with the upcoming election. This is a company that has a highly sophisticated approach to TikTok is an AI company. It's not a social media network. And we sort of failed to recognize what was happening. The kind of cute memes and the funny dancing videos obscures what's actually going on behind the scenes. And again, I think if it was a different administration and the language was a little different, we would be probably paying attention in a different way. If this was an Obama administration saying,
still be mad. I think TikTok is amazing. So what is TikTok?
That's exactly the point, Leo. TikTok is amazing. It's easy to use. Grandparents can use it. Instagram is complicated. Snap is very complicated. So this is a well-designed...
Yeah, Instagram made a competitor that's unusable. Reels... TikTok is easy. Anybody can do it. It's fun. And I love watching the videos.
That's right. This is ByteDance is a Chinese company. And again, this is not about sino-mongering or fear-mongering or anything like that. This is specific to this company. But ByteDance is a company that has helped roll out the Chinese social credit score and a lot of different parts of the country. And
I did not know that.
Again, we're talking about algorithmic determinism and automatic scoring, I have a close friend who I see almost every week who is Chinese, who uses WeChat and the enormous
also
number
blocked,
of
blocked also to be
so the social media that you've never heard of before because you can't get access to it without a Chinese phone number. But she posted two videos. There's a video of her with two teenagers jumping into a pool. One of the teenagers is a boy.
Yeah.
It's there's nothing interesting at all. It's three people. The video lasted like 7 seconds. Three people. It's a teenage girl, full bathing suit, so nothing salacious. Her and a boy, he jumps in. Her entire account got locked. And the reason was because he was in the shot without a shirt on. How else do you go swimming in the United States, right? But that got locked down. There was another time that she had a different account, and the Chinese national anthem was playing kind of by accident in the background. And again, she got permanently banned.
Yeah, but how does that impact our national security? I mean, it's bad for teenage boys without shirts.
Because it's not like they have an army of 15,000 people sort of watching all of these videos.
No, that's automated, right? Yeah.
They have a very... So, you know, again, I wonder the Google problems that Mike was describing, if Baidu has... You know, has similar janky issues. My assumption is probably not, for many different reasons. But the point is, if the data are domiciled in China, which they are, then they are subject to the CCP. And at any time, the CCP can say, you know, we'd like to pull files on every single person who meets these criteria, every single gay person, every single person who has ever posted a video about, you know, whatever.
I mean, surely the U.S. under the Patriot Act can do exactly the same thing if they claim national security grounds. Not on social, but they can pull...
So they could go to Facebook and say, hey, Facebook, I want it all. They could do that. Of course they could.
Yeah.
And they don't even need to go to Facebook, right? There are all of these different data companies that have all this
already
data
collecting
collected.
It. Yeah.
And it's easy to buy it. Anyone can go buy it. The U.S. government buys stuff from those companies all the time. So I'm still trying to figure out how ByteDance is somehow different, other than the fact that it's based in China. Why is this such a big concern as compared to all of the data that's out there from other apps?
The one thing I've heard that makes a little sense is that algorithmically they could... I mean, look what's going on Facebook. QAnon wouldn't really exist except Facebook has in effect, not intentionally, but in effect promoted it. ByteDance could, in theory, use the same techniques to promote something that was in the Chinese government interest somehow. It could be as a propaganda engine, I guess. But is that what you're talking about, Amy, or is there something more nefarious going on?
I don't know the playbook yet, but there is a huge difference between a company that has data. I mean, it is difficult to describe how fast and large how fast this company has grown. They're the number one social... They are far more popular than...
Can't you say the same things about Facebook?
Sure. I guess the difference is if China came in and either secretly or overtly tried to buy access to Facebook data, either directly or through a third party, that would... There are channels to do something about that. There are not existing channels beyond CFIUS. I don't know that the Patriot Act applies. I mean, I don't know. We're sort of in uncharted territory. And what the end uses for these data are, I don't know right now. But
I don't know what Mark Zuckerberg's doing with all the data he's got. But I do know that I personally blame him and Facebook for some of the problems we face in this country right now. Should we ban Mark Zuckerberg?
Facebook has a lot of problems too.
Yeah. Here, this is a very... This headline from 1-0 on Medium is very provocative. Jumana Abu Ghazala, an unelected monarch is shaping our public life. His name is Mark Zuckerberg. The most important election this year has only one voter, and then that picture of Mark with...
they've already admitted they are saying, we're not going to censor the, is it Diamond and Silk people? Because that would cause too much of a PR problem. Never mind the fact that they're putting out complete falsehoods, but we're not going to censor it because it's a PR problem. It does seem like Facebook is becoming like Foxbook at the moment.
I don't, it's not even that. I'm not even worried about slant or bias. I think it's a weapon. And I think the people who know how to use it, I think QAnon is a very good example. I think they've used Facebook particularly, other media as well, but Facebook particularly, to spread a gospel that is very dangerous. And, you know, there we've looked. The United States has been rife with conspiracy theories since 1776. You know, I blame King George for that. But that's
Well, you know, obviously you would have been better off if the British had been in control. And you'd admit it properly. You could have warm beards like old people. You know, you could even spell color properly.
I'm reading a wonderful book by Eric Larson called The Splendid and the Vile about the Battle of Britain. And one of the problems that they had in Britain was the rapid dissemination of false rumors that things like, oh, yeah, don't go in the bomb shelters because once they get bombed and everybody dies, they just brick it up and it's a giant katastrophe. Or, you know, the Germans have built a bomb, a devastating giant bomb they're going to drop tonight. And these things were right, you know, right. But what they didn't have is Facebook. This had to go over the fence, but, you know, one neighbor telling another. Imagine if they'd had Facebook.
Well, you see, my grandfather was a postmaster in the Second World War. And
how did he feel about sorting machines? I'm sorry, go ahead.
Wow, don't get me started on that. But no, I mean, in 1940, he told the tale to my mum and, you know, the rest of the family. A very well-dressed woman came in and said, I need to send a telegram to my husband down in Kent saying to get the family treasures buried because the Germans have invaded.
Yeah.
They're already in Kent. Yeah. They're already in Dover. And you need to get stuff out. And he was in a panic for 12 hours because that was
what
people knew.
Yeah.
Yeah. And Facebook is doing, you know, this is the same problem over
they're
again.
They're doing it at scale.
So scale. Can I offer another?
Please.
Okay. So where are people making their TikTok videos? For the most part, they are making them in their homes, right? So you've got a company that has best-in-class computer vision software. Again, think of TikTok not as a social media company, but as an AI powerhouse. You've got hundreds of millions of people constantly showing their spaces. And let's say that China is plotting out war 10 years from now in economic terms. And in the process, they are learning about how and what types of devices we have and where we tend to spend our time. You know, China could cripple the United States economy
They don't need TikTok to do that. They make everything that they see on the vision. They already know.
The problem is that every device is made in China.
All they'd have to say is, let's shut down Shenzhen and see how the Americans like it.
I would urge us to not use previous wars or our previous experience as we think about how things evolve from here. Now, did the Trump administration botch this whole communication and what they're doing? Of course they did. It doesn't mean that there's not some validity in thinking through what data are being scraped, either implicitly on the back end or what's being shown.
No, I got
in
it.
The video
I got
message
it.
Happened.
Yeah. So what are they going to do? So it's not. It's obviously not a shooting war. But what is the kind of economic warfare that China would engage in? What would their goal be? This is one of the reasons I think I still believe that if we're trading partners, if they buy our soybeans and they make our phones, they're less likely to want to take us out. But what would taking us out mean? Would it be economic destroying us economically? Why would they do that?
Because part of this has to do with pride. The United States, you know, having lived outside of the United States for a long time, you know, a lot of people don't like us. We're kind of shitty to a lot of people in a lot of places.
Well, you could ask the same thing. Why would what does Putin care what happens in the U.S.? Same thing, right?
So part of this is pride.
Okay, sorry. Seriously, go to China and look at the museums there. If you go to any Chinese history museum, they will record how the US, UK, Germany, France took over a section of their country.
Right.
What they essentially did was take over Manhattan and say, our rules apply here. We're going to fight wars to sell drugs to your people.
The Boxer Rebellion. And, absolutely. Understand that.
So they.
But that's history.
Absolutely no. No.
Are you saying that out of spite, they're just going to say, oh, we don't. Let's just what would they do? They'd pull the plug on America?
It's not out of spite. It's about retribution. You know, it's basically, you did this to us. How on earth are you going to turn around and say, this is bad if we do it to you?
No, I agree. But what do they want to do?
Well, the economic argument that I hear made a lot is China doesn't work without the United States. That's true today. But China, I mean, what happens when you've aligned every emerging economy on your side?
Right.
Suddenly, you've got a compounding effect, and you don't need to rely on us as much. And there are plenty of arguments to be made that would say, what would a future look like in which the United States is still very strong and we still have a very good economy, but is beholden to China in much more profound ways than we are right now?
The fact that Tencent owns a minority stake in virtually every company in the United States.
So again, how did we get to that place? Because a year and a half ago, I was meeting with I was in Los Angeles meeting with Japanese government officials and some CEOs of companies that you know, trying to explain to them why they needed to pay attention to TikTok and why it's dangerous for China to be caught in a proxy battle between the United States. They were unaware of what Tencent was, let alone TikTok.
As was I. Forget the politics of it. Should we ban TikTok? Would that be a good idea?
I don't know that that's feasible. I can tell you that I don't have TikTok on a device, and nobody that I know has TikTok on a device. I enjoy the videos. I watch them using third party systems, but there is no way I would install that on anything.
Is the risk to creators on TikTok only, or by what? I never create anything on TikTok, but I like to look at it.
Do we need the Papa John's founder, who's a total tool, and his TikToks?
Hashtag
better lives? No.
I don't look at his TikToks.
But the thing that gets me about all of this is just the idea that focusing so much on TikTok, because there's so much already involved in, you know, between China and the US, where when we focus specifically on TikTok and say, you know, they have to divest or they have to, you know, they'll be blocked in the US, that can lead to retaliation by China already. And they have lots of other ways that they can retaliate. And I think the focus on TikTok is so misguided, as opposed to like figuring out a broader strategy. I agree that there are concerns about China and how it is integrated into the U.S. economy, but I think focusing so much on TikTok is going to backfire in a really big way.
By the way, that's why we're all wearing weird wigs. It's to distract the Chinese, and they're going to watch this and say, well, don't worry about them. They're nuts.
Oh, I was going to say, I thought you were talking about distracting the facial recognition algorithm.
Yeah, that too.
Right now, it wouldn't though.
No, I know.
Alibaba has a really good system where even if you've got Sense Time and Megvii,
even with masks?
It works with a full mask. Yeah, I mean, you could be recognized by, I don't need your face to recognize you. If I've got gait and posture, you know, and voice.
Eye shape and yeah.
So this is a sensible thing. And the sensible thing would be to put the word out, get rid of TikTok on your phone. And if you're a TikTok creator, where should they go? What do they do?
Well, this is the challenge. I think the reason that TikTok took off the way it was in opposition to the vitriol on Twitter and Facebook.
Right.
And Snapchat somehow got somewhat uncool. I don't know what the Snapchat
TikTok's is, my happy place.
I think that tells us something, right? The problem is, it's not, you can't just stand up another network. What TikTok and ByteDance are building unbelievable recognition and automation systems. And that's what is impressive.
Mike wrote, or actually it wasn't Mike, it was Carl on TechDirt, a really good point, but makes your point, Mike. The idea that banning TikTok thwarts Chinese intelligence in any way is ridiculous. They've already got hooks into us in a million ways, right?
Well, hang on. They took the OPM's databases. They have the security clearances of all the people who are, you know, the idea that TikTok is in some way a threat. This is ridiculous.
Well, you're also assuming that it's just sort of top level people with security clearances. What happens if you've got the vast majority of people between the ages of, 6 and 26 today. What happens 10 years from now? Again, I think...
But you're not implying that the Chinese government is going to march in the United States and round up every gay person.
No, I'm not suggesting that.
I wouldn't put it past them, to be honest. But
really? Because I'd be worried if that's the future you're talking about.
Honestly, Amy.
Sorry, you go, Ian.
Okay, I mean, I'm sorry. This is the future we're looking at the moment. We have the ability... if you ignored ethics and the rest of it, to actually, find every gay person, find every out gay person, find everyone with uncomfortable political beliefs. We can do this right now. It's a question as a society as whether or not we allow that to happen. And I'm not trusting the Chinese government to not allow that to happen. And honestly, not really trusting the US or UK governments to do the same either.
Mike, one last thought before I move on.
I mean, I think that there are real concerns about China. I think focusing it all on TikTok is a mistake. And
I agree.
I think it's a distraction. And I think that by focusing it on TikTok, we actually give the Chinese an excuse to do something back. And I just think it's the wrong approach.
What would you recommend? Let's all acknowledge Amy's point. So what do we do? Do we move every factory back in the United States? Is that even feasible?
I think that is also the reverse solution. I mean, I think that your initial instincts were kind of where I land as well, which is that the more that we can make sure that China is also reliant on the U.S., that we're both reliant on each other, that then we have power and influence over them, that we prevent the sort of dystopian situations that we're talking about. Are there risks there? Yeah, absolutely. But I think that, it's the answer can't be to close off and trying to shut them off and sort of, separate out the world and fragment everything. I don't think that's a real solution either.
Amy, are you a kind of a Kissingerian realpolitik advocate here, or what kind of policy going forward, if you could be in charge, would you recommend?
I have a degree in game theory. So
okay.
Most of my
good. That's very useful.
So I tend to fall back on the belief that the best way forward is one in which we can't win unless China also wins.
Right.
Right. So we need to be in it. We need to create a situation in which we both lose together. We both win together. That is much easier said than done.
We need to set up a prisoner's dilemma, in effect.
An artificial one. But it needs to be economic in scope.
Right.
And the challenge is that the longer that we wait to develop something like that, the harder it's going to be. And China has been in the process of making new alliances around the world at the same time that we are angering our alliances around the world. So I think there's a way forward, but it has to be much more, Mike is right. This is not just about TikTok. And we shouldn't die on the mountain that is TikTok. But, Tencent is an issue. Alibaba is an issue. Baidu is an issue. Megvi is an issue. That SenseTime is an issue. We have a lot of issues.
Microsoft buying TikTok's American assets would have no benefit to anybody, including Microsoft, I think.
Well, actually, it would have a significant benefit to the Trump government, the way he sells it.
He's going
to
get
a large cut of the...
Yeah.
When did this happen? Seriously, when did the American government say, we will okay things?
It doesn't go into Mr. Trump's pocket. It goes to the Treasury.
Well, yeah, which might go that makes it pocket.
No, we don't know where that goes after that. Yeah.
Sorry, this is not free enterprise. This is just
That smells.
But I'm really looking forward to the TikTok LinkedIn synergies. So.
Oh my God, TikTok resumes. I would just be done.
You know what? You've changed my mind though, Amy, because I really until now said, this is silly. It's just a fun social network. What are you worried about? you've convinced me that there's some deeper, darker side to this. I had no idea Tencent was involved in the social credit system in China, or that they were an AI company.
Not Tencent.
ByteDance.
I don't know that Tencent is not, but ByteDance. But right. Yes.
Well, Tencent is another example of, you know, and that's ostensibly a private company, right? It's not a Chinese government entity.
Well, I mean, again, there is no truly private company.
Right. But they have 5%, 10% stake. They have 5% in Tesla. They own big, you know, significant stakes in many, many American, in Reddit. They have 10% of Reddit. So maybe this kind of, there's some sort of economic, I don't know. It's above my pay grade. I don't understand it. I was hoping you might.
Tencent has like 22 or so billion, somewhere between $20 and $25 billion worth of U.S. assets. That's not an insignificant amount of money.
Yeah. And see, I love China. I was a Chinese studies major in college. I love the culture. I love the people. When I've been to China, I've enjoyed every minute of it. So I am not, I don't want to be a Sinophobe. But on the other hand, maybe we have to be realistic about the dangers that they pose.
I also just really quickly want to highlight that the one terrible outcome of all of this is that Americans become fearful or antagonistic or racist towards
Chinese people. That's my big fear. Yeah.
We have to be very, very careful of making sure that the conversation, and I don't think that people who work at Tencent have it out for people in the United States. These are geopolitical problems that, right. that have been around since before I was alive. Right. So,
absolutely.
You know.
Right.
So.
A little break, then a surprise. No, I'm not going to wear a blue wig. This Week in Tech brought to you this week by ExpressVPN. You know that's the VPN provider I use and recommend because they protect my privacy. I know they don't do any logging. I know they actually, they've been audited. They have third-party audits. They use a technology called Trusted Server that prevents them from logging any of my traffic. So I know I've got privacy there. But it's also more secure and nowadays, we're all watching a lot of TV. It's also, it turns out, a great way to get around geographic restrictions on the things you watch on TV. And this is not illegal. This is not even immoral. If you're paying for Netflix, maybe you've watched everything good on Netflix US. I have. But now, with ExpressVPN, I can unlock thousands of new shows and movies from streaming libraries all over the globe. And the one thing that's great about ExpressVPN, it's fast enough to do that. A lot of VPNs, you would never want to watch HD video because it's just too slow. I leave ExpressVPN on all the time on my devices because I don't even notice it's there. Still can watch HD video, no buffering. And it's on everything I use, iOS, Android, Windows, Mac, Linux, even our TVs, our smart devices. ExpressVPN works with many streaming services. They're in over 100 countries. So that means you can go to that country. For instance, here's what I do. I fire up Netflix. I'm a subscriber. I take ExpressVPN. Normally it picks the server nearest you, the fastest server. But I say, no. Instead of that, let's go to London today. And now I'm watching. I refresh Netflix. Suddenly I can see Doctor Who. I can see all the Blackadders I want. I love Blackadder. I can go to Canada and watch Brooklyn Nine-Nine or Rick and Morty in Netflix France. You haven't seen anything until you've seen Rick et Morty in France. It's good stuff. Fresh Prince of Bel-Air in Australia, eh? How about that? Just change your location, hit connect, refresh the page, and you can watch it. ExpressVPN works with Amazon Prime, with Netflix, with BBC's iPlayer, with YouTube. It's fast, it's easy. And if you use my link right now at expressvpn.com/twit, 3 extra months free with a 1-year package. Go to expressvpn.com/twit and get the extra 3 months as part of that deal. 15 months for the price of 12. expressvpn.com/twit. It's the only VPN I use, the one I recommend. I've got it on all my devices. I've got it on my TV too. expressvpn.com/twit. Privacy, security, and Rick and Morty in France. What more could you ask for? I mean, honestly, that's all I'd ever want. So I told you I had a shocker. President Trump thinks says he's considering a pardon for Edward Snowden. What?
Yeah. Every day I wake up and it's like chat roulette
what
the news at this point. I don't know what I'm going to get and how blinded I'm going to be once I get there.
What? President Trump, in an interview with the New York Post, that bastion of journalism and integrity, said, there, quote, there are a lot of people who think that Snowden's not being treated fairly by U.S. law enforcement. I'm going to start looking at it. This is at his Bedminster.
This is one of the problems. Yes, Snowden is not being treated fairly by the U.S. legal system, but I don't honestly think that Donald Trump is going to do anything better about this.
You know what's so strange? This is all flipped because he was a hero, right? And he told us what the NSA was up to. Then he fled to Russia. And now the same people who lionized him 5 years ago are saying, you know what? I think he's a Russian pawn. He's a Putin pawn. I can't. Life is too fast for me. Slow down.
I mean, well, I've got to say, Mike.
Go ahead, Mike.
I'm curious on your view on this, yeah. But I got to say, Snowden strikes me as a patriot who, you know, did other things.
That's last year's thinking, Ian.
Yeah, I think that he was a whistleblower, right? I mean, he exposed things that the NSA was doing that were bad and I think violated the Fourth Amendment and caused a lot of problems. And I think that the government has treated him very, very badly. I also will note, by the way, that in 2013, Trump himself issued a tweet where he said that he thought Snowden should be executed. So his own views seem to shift over time, depending on what is going on. And there is a feeling that, you know, like so many things with Trump, when a reporter asks him a question, he will say, yes, of course, we're looking into that, when he doesn't really have much of an idea of what he's actually talking about. So I would be surprised if he does anything. But, that would be like, you know, one of the rare good things that I think the president would do if he did issue a pardon. I'm not holding my breath, and I don't think Edward Snowden is holding his breath that Trump would actually pardon him either.
And then there's this. The White House is planning to, with its new defense budget, increase AI and quantum funding by 30%.
Yeah, Palantir's going to get a big payday out of this.
So there's a backstory here. So
okay.
Michael
oh, great.
Used to be the, so okay, so Michael just got appointed the head of basically R&D and engineering.
He's the CTO, Michael Kratsios.
No. He was the CEO.
CTO.
He was the CTO, sorry, CTO. He is now within DOD. He's in the Pentagon and has the largest. He's managing a $60 billion with a B dollar budget. He was formerly and as far as I know, has never managed anywhere close to that type of budget or been in charge of R&D activities in this way.
He does say we're going to be winning.
Okay.
He says, we need to make sure we're winning and leading in the technologies of today.
I agree with that. But again, he was Peter Thiel's chief of staff leading into this.
Okay.
So I don't...
He's a little young. He's 33 years old.
You know, this is a big... This is the part of the DOD that makes big bets on big strategic decisions. I don't know. I know that he was well liked among some staffers at State and some staffers at OSTP that I know. But I am baffled by this appointment and the significant responsibility that he's been given. Which could all be gone in a matter of months if there is a changeover, but. Yeah, obviously we should be heavily invested in different types of approaches to warfare, but the connections now between all of the different investments that Peter Thiel has and some of the relationships that the federal government has had with traditional.
Do you think this
companies.
Is really just going to be a funnel from the taxpayers right into Peter Thiel's pocket?
I don't know.
I think so. The other question is should we be spending $1 billion on quantum information science, or is this really very blue sky still?
Well, I mean, to get back to what we were talking about earlier, you know, blue sky stuff
Got to do it.
Is the kind of stuff that you hope the government does invest in. So I'm not so upset about that part of it. I mean, I think, you know, it's good to see the government investing in pure research, and this is definitely sort of a pure research area.
Yeah, if we had this story 10 years ago, 5 years ago, we would go, go team. Now I don't know.
Though I will say one thing that I'm skeptical about is you know, whenever it's framed as a race, you know, the race to 5G, the race to AI, the race to quantum computing, I think that's all nonsense.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's just sort of hype.
No, we got to do the blue sky. And yeah, I kind of made fun of an article a couple of weeks ago where a reporter, I think, kind of misunderstood where this was after the Chicago announcement that we were going to do more research into a quantum internet where hackers couldn't hack because when you observe quantum particles, they change. So so hackers can't hack that, right? And also there was a magical, using quantum entanglement, magical way for two machines in different locations to talk to each other instantaneously, kind of like the Ansible. And I thought maybe that's a little premature to announce that, just a little. But maybe we'll have it. Who knows?
Everyone likes that headline.
I'm the idiot who bought the Microsoft Duo. What do I know? I always like to mention the passing of, and unfortunately it's become more and more common, of internet pioneers. Russell Kirsch, who invented the Pixel. One wouldn't think the Pixel would need to be invented, but yes, it would. Passed away in Portland this week at the age of 91. He was at the National Bureau of Standards as a member of the Standards Eastern Automatic Computer Team. This is 1951 when they had teams. And he was in charge of handling the U.S.'s first programmable computer. There it is, an image of his infant son, 176 pixels by 176 pixels. This is in the 50s. He developed a digital image scanner for SEAC that went on to capture the first digital images, including that picture of Walden, his son, who would be about my age now. He invented the Pixel. And then he said, you know, we blew it. The square pixels, that was the logical thing to do. But really, that wasn't the only kind of thing you could do. And it was something very foolish that everyone in the world has been suffering from ever since. So he said, you know, we really should have arbitrary shaped pixels, because then you wouldn't have pixelation.
But that's always the way with technology creators. I interviewed Mark Andreessen, in 95? And he got an angry phone call from Tim Berners-Lee saying, you should not put images into World Wide Web links, because that's not what it's for. It's for documents. And it was like, seriously?
Sorry.
Get out of here.
Sorry. Sorry.
It's the same thing. Thomas Edison, when he listed the 10 things that the phonograph could be used for, playing music was down at number 8.
Yeah.
You know, people don't get, you know, they don't understand the inventions they create.
R.I.P. Russell A. Kirsch, the inventor of the Pixel. Well, that
we also lost Francis Allen.
We talked about that last week. Francis Allen, who invented parallel optimizing compilers and parallel compilation. It was a big
didn't get a Turing Award until 2006.
Yeah,
seriously,
I know.
They couldn't have put Amazing Grace in there earlier. But anyway, that's another rant.
Hey, before we move off of this, can we just take a moment, because these things never get said enough while everybody's alive, but there's a group of unsung heroes in the middle of the virus, and that's everybody working in IT who are keeping our systems running and our phones working and our cameras working. And they are under incredible stress and don't get near the amount of public adulation that they should. So
bless you. If anybody should thank them, it is us. Could Amy look like that if it weren't for our heroes of IT, ladies and gentlemen? Do you have a green screen behind you? Because it's really an excellent
I
Mac.
Don't. This is, I think Skype must have updated.
Yeah.
I don't. This is just, I'm sitting in my office at home, and this is amazing. The green screen is much better on this than on Zoom.
Yeah. Skype clearly works best with purple wigs. That's obvious.
Obvious.
That's Amy Webb, and you are always a joy to have on the show, and you always open my mind. I learn something every single time you're on. FutureTodayInstitute.com if you want to learn about her work helping governments and organizations, instead of just throwing stuff against the wall, actually plan for the future, because she knows what it's going to be. Thank you. Thank you, Amy. It's always a pleasure to have you on. And I'm going to delete TikTok as soon as the show's over. I'm going to be sad. Gonna be sad. I was learning some new dances, but okay. I'm gonna delete it. I don't want it to be.
Put TikTok on your new Surface foldy screen thing.
Well, that's what I was thinking. It's gonna be the perfect TikTok machine, but I'll have to find something else. I already got rid of Facebook and Instagram and WhatsApp. I'm not, you know, I don't want to be a portal to the future or something. I don't know. They could find. You know what? I don't care if people know what I'm up to. If you want Chinese government, I'll put a camera in my house. Oh, wait a minute. Too late. That's Ian Thompson. He is dapper as hell in his greenish mustache and hair and eyebrows. Oh. And please apologize to your beautiful wife.
I have to shower immediately afterwards. But it has been tremendous fun. And Carsten is a very persuasive person. But no, it's tremendous fun.
Ian's at theregister.com, where he's in charge. He's news editor, so he's in charge of all the most important stuff, writing the good headlines. Thank you, Ian. It's great to see you again. And Mike Masnick, we love you and your blue hair. He's the first blue-haired old lady we've ever had on this show.
No, excellent. Yeah,
thrilled to have you. TechDirt.com. I hope you can figure out a way around the Google ad black hole you've fallen into. That sucks.
We'll see. We'll see. We'll be experimenting.
Do you allow people to like subscribe or support you?
Yeah. Yeah, we have. We have at the top of the page, there's a support TechDirt tab, and that lists lots of different ways that you can support
TechDirt.
Please
do. Yeah.
And there's all sorts of ways. We try and make it as easy as possible for people to support us. And
there's a Patreon. And there's, of course, those great TechDirt YouTube takedown masks. Which everybody, I've got to order some. Lots of great tech dirt merch.
We have lots of different stuff. And so.
And, of course, Tech Dirt has a podcast, which you can find on SoundCloud.
Yeah. And we have lots of different guests. We have some really interesting ones coming up. We had, just this past week, we had a really interesting, small company that's building exercise equipment, but they actually encourage people to build their own copies of it.
Oh,
which I thought was really cool. Interesting. Yeah. You know, they didn't freak out about people copying them.
Nice.
They actually encourage people to. So I thought it was a really interesting conversation.
That's really great. Thank you, Mike. Really appreciate all you do. Keep up the great work at TechDirt.com. Thank you all for being here. We always have fun doing this show, wigs or not. You don't have to wear one to watch it anyway or listen to it. If you haven't seen the video, get the video today. It's a little weird. We also have audio available. All of that you can get at our website, twit.tv. We're on YouTube. And, of course, you can subscribe in your favorite podcast client. If you want to watch the live version of the show, you can get that, the live stream, any Sunday at around, it starts around 2:15 Pacific, 5:15 Eastern. The show usually gets underway about half an hour later, but you can watch the pre-show as we get set up and all of that stuff. That behind-the-scenes stream is at twit.tv/live. 2:15 Pacific, 5:15 Eastern time, 21:15 UTC of a Sunday evening. Our chat room is irc.twit.tv. Great people hanging out there as they watch live. Please take advantage of that. It's a great geek confab. And you can always get the show on your favorite voice assistant. Just say, hey, you, play This Week in Tech podcast, and you'll get the latest episode. Or play Twit Live, and often it will play the live stream. Sometimes not. Sometimes I get a song by Rosemary Clooney. I don't know why. It's just only the artificial intelligence.
That's totally random. Yeah. I played piano for her once.
Did you?
I accompanied her. Yeah.
Where? When? How?
I
don't just drop that into the show and leave it.
I
did you play Come On to My House? My house. You got to feed me.
She was really struggling, I think, with alcoholism at that point. I was a sub in for bands that when they needed an extra set of hands. So she forgot the words. She was struggling with Rudolph. It's a Christmas show. And Yeah, but
I loved
very
her.
Great.
I loved her. Yeah. Grew up watching her in White Christmas, incredible, of course. Talent. And her nephew, George, did pretty well, too, for himself a little later on. Thank you. Well, I'm learning stuff about you, Amy, every time. So you were like a band? You played in a band? You played piano in a band?
I dropped out of music school.
Oh.
I was a performance. I had gotten recruited when I was a freshman. So I started off in music school against my wishes and then dropped out. So I have a background. I'm a terrible musician.
To make your mom happy. But you had that mathematical mind because game theory. Wow. That's fun.
Yeah, I had a scholarship, so there was was that or working, I guess something else.
Working for a living.
Yep.
Thanks, everybody. We'll see you next time. Another twit.
This is amazing.